Will act if Tehran kills peaceful protesters. What are the wider implications of what's happening? At 11, universities are now giving lifelong career advice after a major upsurge in graduates who choose later in life to change their careers. And at 12, Bridget Phillotson says people who can't read are a danger to our national security. Really? And how are our reading habits changing?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. Authorities say DNA or dental records will be needed to identify victims of a New Year fire at a Swiss ski resort. More than 40 people died and around 100 others have been badly injured after it broke out in Kron, Montana yesterday. Switzerland's holding 5 days of national mourning. These people witnessed what happened.
I feel like it's actually a nightmare that I'm going to wake up. And last night, I didn't sleep a second. I couldn't. I closed my eyes and everything kept coming back to me because I saw people being resuscitated. I saw people completely burned.
It was really chaotic and really sad scene, especially people who had been burned. I saw people on the floor, not moving. I tried to get them into other bars and get them in the warm and give people my coat, as they had little more on them than burnt clothing.
A vaccine protecting against chickenpox is being rolled out on the NHS for the first time. Children across the UK will be offered a combined jab alongside the MMR vaccine. Until now, parents wanting to protect their children have had to pay up to £200 for the vaccine privately. Stephanie Tingley, who's a nurse at Great Ormond Street Hospital, says it's great news.
There's some children or families that are worried about their children going to school because of catching chickenpox, because it can make them really unwell. As a previous intensive care nurse, I've seen children that have been hospitalised because of it. And if we can do anything to reduce the effects of chickenpox, I think it's brilliant.
Weather warnings for snow and ice have been issued across large parts of the UK. Snow is forecast to fall heaviest in northern parts of Scotland later. Cold alerts also remain in place across the whole of England. Donald Trump claims his health is perfect, but admits he takes more aspirin than doctors recommend and finds exercise boring. The US president's been speaking to the Wall Street Journal amid ageing concerns. In the city, the FTSE 100 has risen above 10,000 for the first time. A short time ago, it was trading up 81 points at 10,012. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather cold with a widespread frost this morning. Some heavy snow showers across northern Scotland. Sunshine further south with highs of 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lucinda Horsley.
Get that Euro Millions feeling this Friday.
10 UK winners are guaranteed to be millionaires.
That's 10 more reasons to celebrate. Not a bad way to start the new year.
Euro Millions from the National Lottery. Play on app.
Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Ian Dale.
Very good morning to you. It's 3 minutes past ten. Do you remember the other day I said it often snows at New Year? Well, what happened this morning? I walked out of my front door around, 20 past seven, and there was snow on the ground in Tunbridge Wells. Doesn't happen very often. I was like a child. Still am, to be honest. I love a bit of snow over Christmas and the New Year. Never get it at Christmas, though, do we? Now, I have come to the conclusion that the whole of the British media seems to be asleep over Iran. Nobody is talking about it. It's hardly, barely featuring in the national newspapers. Been a couple of pieces on news bulletins on other stations and on the TV news, but not to the extent that you would expect. Why not? I mean, surely anyone can see that this is a major story, and it could, I emphasise the word could, lead to massive changes in Iran if these protests maybe carry a bit more clout than the last round did in 2022. So why do you think it is that people just aren't seeming to take notice of what is going on in Iran, because Iran is a big country. It's a major power in the Middle East. It has influence in all sorts of different ways, which we've talked about over the years on LBC. But yet no one seems to really be highlighting what's going on in Iran at the moment. Now, we did on Tuesday or Wednesday? We're doing it again this morning. And I want to ask you several questions, particularly if you and your family originally hail from Iran. What are you hearing about the impact of these protests? Because they're not just happening in one or two places. They are, from what we can gather, happening all over Iran, in lots of cities all over the place. Partly based on the economic situation, because the value of the riyal is at its lowest ever. That's the Iranian currency. Inflation is high, somewhere between 70 and 80% at the moment. Unemployment is increasing. And there are genuine problems, not just for the poorest in Iranian society, but for the middle classes as well, in being able to actually feed their families. Now, that is a tinderbox for protest, and these are happening. The regime is reacting. They've made many arrests. Several protesters have been killed. And that's prompted Donald Trump to get involved. He has warned today on his Truth Social platform that Iran and the US, warned Iran that the US will come to the rescue, his word, of protesters if Tehran responds violently to the largest nationwide demonstrations that the country has faced in 3 years. Now, in his post early this morning, Donald Trump said, and I'm quoting his words now, if Iran shoots and violently kills peaceful protesters, which is their custom, the United States of America will come to their rescue. We are locked and loaded and ready to go. Locked and loaded, eh? That's quite a phrase, isn't it? What does that actually mean, though? What could the United States do to either promote these protests or intervene so that the regime could not repress them? I'm not quite sure what that all means. A lot of you, when we were talking about this earlier in the week, made the point that we, the United States, all countries in the West should just stay out of it. And I can see why a lot of people think that, because Western interventions in Middle Eastern countries haven't, shall we say, always gone that well, have they? But on the other hand, the Iranian people, I think, have felt let down when they've tried to protest against their regime in the past, where they felt that there was a tacit implication, particularly, I think, back in 2008-9, that the United States would come to their rescue, and it didn't. So what do you think should happen? How could we support the protesters, or indeed, should we? 0345 6060 973. Well, let's get the latest on the situation in Iran from Nazanin Ansari. She's an Iranian journalist and managing editor of the Persian language news website, Kayhan London, and the English language website, Kayhan Life. Nazanin, very good morning to you. Are these protests widening now? Are they happening in more places than they were earlier in the week?
Good morning, Ian, and thank you very much for having me on your program. Yes, the protests have, expanded to 45 cities across Iran. And if I could give you an indication of the geographical span, is from western Iran through central Iran through the Caspian North, reaching the northeast and down to the southern coast. So as you see, it is nationwide. And we have seen this kind of protest of we have seen protests in Iran since the beginning of the revolution. But since 2017, the protests don't have an Islamic tone to them. And they're more nationalistic. They want, a downfall of the regime. Specifically for this one, if you compare it to 2022, Women, Life, Freedom one, is that people do have an alternative in mind. And we are hearing more and more chants in support of Reza Pahlavi, the crown prince of Iran, Prince Reza Pahlavi, who in the past couple of months, maybe actually since summer, has really increased his campaign as far as reaching out to the military and intelligence and those who are, the divisions within the Islamic Republic. But at the same time, the difference between this time 2026 and 2022 is that, number one, we've got the business class, the merchants, the middle class, as you mentioned in your introduction, who are now have lost most of their standard of living, and they have joined in. It started in the merchant district, in the industrial zones. But at the same time, the regime itself is not the regime. The state itself has lost all its firepower, its teeth, the ones that it had in 2021, 2022. It has lost its proxies. It is, Hezbollah is suffering. Hamas has been, has suffered. In this sense, it is not the same kind of, regime that was so adamant and so powerful that it could break down these demonstrations. Let's not forget, after the 12-day war with Israel, even the military, the IRGC, recognized that despite all their bravado, the regime was not able to hold on to the skies of Iran for more than 12 hours. Mm. And at the same time, because of the worsening economic situation, members of the Basij, of the military, of IRGC, they are people. They have to eat, and they don't have enough to eat. Their living standards are even lower than what they see the militia in Hezbollah and Hamas are receiving from money from the Islamic Republic. So we are receiving a lot of videos and statements from members. There was one in particular, I think 2-3 weeks ago, of a member of the IRGC complaining to Khamenei that he has to sell his kidney in order to be to maintain his living for his family. And there was one video in particular of a resident who sent out this video saying that he always wanted to have a shoe cupboard. But then he opened his refrigerator door and he said, now I have a shoe cupboard, but it's my refrigerator because it's empty. That is this, that explains the state, the standard of living inside Iran for the not so well off, which includes the middle class.
And also that will include the families of the Iranian police and military, the Iranian army. And often, when there are revolutions, the tipping point for a revolution is when the police or the army turn against the regime. Is there any sign of that happening here so far?
Yes, in the sense that from what we hear, number one, from the camp of the prince, when he started his campaign, over more than 100,000 joined from contacted him from the IRGC and the military. Now it remains to be seen how many of them were, bona fide members of the police and intelligence and also others. But what we are seeing is actually a split within the top leadership of the Islamic Republic. Amongst the ministers, the so-called reformists, their camp is actually splitting up. We saw that in the past week, for example, they had to replace the member, the head of the Central Bank of Iran, brought in someone else to replace him, as not as an economic move, but rather a political move to allay the fears of reformists within the government. We also saw the resignation of Mr. Pezeshkian's political secretary, who was also really important in the sense that he was he provided the international aspect, international advice to him. He had been ambassador to Moscow before that. He was also an aide to Mr. Zarif, the foreign minister, before that. And yesterday we also saw the replacement of another revolutionary guards. So we are seeing a lot of moving blocks. And for observers who just only read what is happening in Western media, specifically Iranians outside of Iran, who only read Western media and who do not listen to your radio, they do not get the correct picture. Because what the regime inside Iran wants to portray is, number one, that these rioters are foreign agents, and actually that line was undermined by Mr. Pezeshkian's government spokesman, and that these are only economic issues and they can be managed.
Thank you very much for talking to us and providing us with such a comprehensive update. That's Nazanin Ansari, an Iranian journalist and managing editor of Kayhan London. That's K-A-Y-H-A-N and Kayhan Life, if you want to look them up. Right, we'll come to your calls in a moment. I want to know your reaction to what Donald Trump has said about intervening in Iran if the regime do intend to react violently and kill protesters. Let's face it, they've already killed some. 0345 6060 973. And why should we be interested in this in this country? Some of you texting in saying this has got nothing to do with us. Why are we even talking about it? Well, I'll try and explain that. Maybe my next guest will after the break. It's 10:15.
LBC.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like. From real Octopus Energy calls.
Your customer service was tip top. You know, I couldn't fault it.
The customer service was really good.
The people are friendly on the telephone. You can always get a problem solved.
Octopus are an absolute breath of fresh air.
People like yourself and all of your colleagues have done such a wonderful job.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running.
The famous five are at home and Julian could barely contain his excitement. "Why are you so excited?" asked George. "Is it your birthday? Is it snowing?" asked Dick. "Are we having treacle sponge tonight?" asked Anne.
"No," said Julian. "It's the Great GWR Getaway Sale."
The Great GWR Getaway Sale is now on. Hurry, book before January 5th at gwr.com or on the app. Great Western Railway. Adventures start here. Terms apply. Selected routes only. Travel by April 10th.
At Kia, we have an award-winning range of electric cars for you to discover. From the compact SUV, the Kia EV3, and our latest hatchback, the Kia EV4, to our stylish new Kia EV5, the all-electric family SUV. Discover what driving electric really means. And if you order any Kia electric car by March 31st, you'll enjoy your first two services free. Search Discover Your Kia EV to book your test drive today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
T's and C's apply.
Ears are great, aren't they? One on each side of your head for stereo. It's because of ears that radio ads can amplify your advertising. 40 million adults listen to commercial radio every week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
17 minutes past 10 on LBC. We're talking about the protests that are going on in Iran. Donald Trump has now intervened and warned that if the Iranian regime reacts violently to the protests and kills any, then the US will come to their aid. I don't know what that means. I don't know what Donald Trump could do or would be willing to do to intervene. It can't be like airstrikes. I mean, what would that achieve? So do you think that it is actually incumbent on Western democracies to intervene to protect Iranian protesters? 0345 6060 973. Fahid Beheshti is a political activist and founder of Iran Front and joins me now. Fahid, thank you very much for joining us. What is Iran Front to start off with?
Thank you very much for having me here. The Iran Front stands for Iran Front for the Revival of Law and National Sovereignty. And we formed this about a year ago. We launched it in European Parliament, and recently, 2 months ago, we had our British launch in House of Lords with the participants of many decision makers in UK. So as you know, we are camping in front of UK Foreign Office for today for 1,047 days and with one very simple demand. Prescribe IRGC. Place IRGC where they belong to. And this is a very simple demand. This is IRGC is the biggest governmental terrorist organization. And we've been camping outside of Foreign Office for nearly 1,050 days and asking our decision makers, our leaders, to do the right things. And they are still undecisive. But
just before you go on, why won't the British government do that? Because there are plenty of MPs. I think the Liberal Democrats, they have a united position on this, but there are plenty of Labour MPs and plenty of Conservative MPs who do want the government to do that. So why do they refuse to do it?
They are not just MPs, you know, because we have the Parliament in, you know, in the time of Conservative, when they were in power, and in the time of Labour, and not just our MPs. We done one polling with JL Partners, great company, 4 months ago, which has been published on Telegraph newspaper. 72%, Ian, 72% of Labour voters, they asking for the prescription of IRGC now. So the government now, they have to decide. But I don't know what is stopping them from taking this right step. But you describe it very well. I didn't see anyone describe the situation as well as yourself in these past 6 days. Yes, they are quiet. They decided somehow to not talk a lot about the situation in Iran. But let's face this reality. The situation in Iran, those people, they come to this dialogue that they say is not our business. Yes, it's your business. For past 20 years, we've been trying really hard to communicate this with our leaders, with our decision makers, that this is your problem, because the Iranian regime is the source of this evil, mad ideology, which the IRGC's mission is to send this ideology to the West. And now we are witnessing this ideology, the chaos that they're creating in our cities. So if we ignore what's happening in Iran, it's here now, and it's too late now.
That's an interesting point, because as I said to the previous guest, I'm getting several text and WhatsApp messages coming in and saying, why has this got anything to do with us? Why should we be interested in what's happening in Iran? Now, you're in a much better position to explain that than I am.
Exactly. Look, today this is a very obvious reality that all our decision makers, leaders, and even not the normal people are agreeing on this. If we are after lasting peace and security in the world, we have to secure lasting peace and security in the Middle East. The only obstacle for lasting peace and security in the Middle East is Iranian regime. And now Iranian people are doing the job for us. So it's the responsibility of any brave leader and decision maker, as Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, which did a great job, is that to support Iranian people. They're doing the job for us. This mad ideology is in middle of our cities now. They are brainwashing our youth. They radicalize our youth and turn them into the enemies of our values, our modern values. The mission, the ideology of Iranian regime is that, for your viewers, is not limited to the border of Iran. They believe this is their divine mission. They have to turn our modern world into Islamic state. And they are using the wealth of this rich country, fifth richest country in the world, in order to do this. That's why 70% of Iranian people at this time living are under the line of poverty line. So this is our problem. We have to see as this other. And the problem we are facing, that's because we have been so naive and ignorance about this situation is not their problem. It's our problem.
Some people are saying the only reason that Donald Trump is interested in Iran is because of its oil reserves.
It's whatever interest Donald Trump has is going to be our interest as well. Look, if we are talking politically, we should look at every situation as common interest. Now, at this specific moment, the interest of Iranian people, the interest of the people of region, the interest of people of Israel, the interest of the people of Europe, America, on its coming together. We have a common interest. This regime is the enemy of our values, is our common enemy. So this is, we have to look at the situation. Whatever way Donald Trump look at the situation, so I doubt it. He's got Venezuela next to it. And Venezuela is got more reserve oil than Saudi Arabia and Iran. So, but this is, when you look at it from this angle that I am describing, this is very, this is what we can say, this is our problem.
And just finally, what happens afterwards? I mean, if these protests are in any way successful, is there any prospect for some sort of secular government model?
Is
that on the table? And that's a question from one of my listeners.
This is exactly, and I invite my great friend, actually, Nazanin Ansari, she's a great friend of mine, and I invite all our friends and the members of opposition to not move fast. At the moment, let's describe it like this. Majority, absolute majority of Iranian people, I can say more than 95% are agreeing on this very important point that this regime must go. But they have, because we are very diverse, Iranian people and our opposition. So they are not agreeing on one person or on one group. That's why we created Iran Front. Iran Front doesn't have any political ideology. Is like a hub for all these different groups and political opposition groups to join, diverse ethnic, religious, and political diversity to join this, to unite for the time of transition. Yes, the Iranian people think they are very well prepared for the time of transition after the fall of this regime. We are preparing. We have a dialogue that can attract all this different diversity. We cannot push or impose one specific group to this diverse group, this diverse opposition that we have, because that put people off and they go back. And this is what happened in Women, Life, Freedom. We tried this few times. We tried to publicize one person and one group. That's why people we put people off and they gone back home. We have to first focus on what people, Iranian people, want and stand next to them. First, they want to get rid of this regime.
Fahid, thank you very much indeed. That's Fahid Beheshti, political activist and founder of Iran Front. I wonder how many of you listening are actually originally from Iran and have contemplated, well, look, if these protests are successful, if there is a change in the regime and maybe a secular regime comes in, I'm not going to say it will be democratic, because I think we all know that countries that have never experienced democracy sometimes don't react well to it. We've seen that in Iraq. But I wonder if you've thought, well, maybe at one point I will feel that I can go back and help rebuild my country. Now, I should slightly make an apology here, because normally I wouldn't go for so long with two guests and not take any phone calls, particularly on this show. But I felt it was important to get their perspective as a bit of, just so we can kick off the discussion with a little bit of authority. Chandra is in Newcastle. Hello, Chandra.
Very good morning, and thanks for taking my call. And thank you for bringing this topic up, because as you said, most people are not paying any attention to this. I've got quite a lot of friends based in the UK who are originally from Iran, many of whom can never go back, have not been able to visit their families for the fear of not being allowed back out of the country. So I am very aware of the dangers with which Iranian people live every day. But there are two parts to the story. One part, obviously, is the oppression and brutality of the Iranian regime. But the second part is obviously the international economic sanctions, which have been more or less in place since 1979, and United States has spearheaded economic sanctions on Iran. I mean, probably for justifiable reasons, but for Donald Trump to today pretend as if he is the harbinger of peace and he loves Iranian people is an absolute nonsense. Iranian people have been in Western media, and Iran as a country, as well as Iranian people, have been painted as in most distasteful color. And as someone who has known, has made French, very deep French with people of Iran, originally from Iran, I find it very difficult.
Sorry, Chandra. Nobody is painting the Iranian people in a negative way. I think everybody has great sympathy with the Iranian people for the situation that they find themselves in. But everyone, well, I would like to think that everyone can see that their government is one of the most evil, disgusting, repressive regimes in the world.
Sometimes the boundaries, I appreciate the nuance which you're showing this morning, and that's really admirable of you. But given time, I can read out articles and print media presentations where the lines between Iranian regime and ordinary Iranian citizens has become blurred to such an extent that, you know, the whole of Iran has been painted as the enemy of the world. And
give me one example of that, because I certainly haven't seen the Iranian people portrayed like that.
I should have come better prepared, but when I call you back again on another day, I should be able to give you...
Yeah, you'll have to do it in the evening, though, because this is my last day covering this slot. But I intend to make sure that this subject does not disappear from the media headlines. I can only do my bit. I know Sheila Fogarty's covered this as well on LBC, as have several of my colleagues. But I'm at a loss to understand why much of the media hasn't given this the prominence that it deserves. And I think that's a crying shame. It may be because the whole of the media disappears over, many people disappear over Christmas. But I hope from next week, when everybody's back to normal, that maybe it will get the coverage elsewhere that it does no doubt deserve. Chandra, thank you very much indeed. Keep your calls coming. 0345 6060 973. I'm detecting on my WhatsApp messages here the same phenomenon that we get on the Russia-Ukraine war, where there are Iranian apologists flooding my inbox at the moment. I will read a few of them out because I think it's very instructive what these people are saying, as if the Iran regime is some benevolent democracy that only cares for its people. Well, if you actually look at what this regime has done over the last 40 years, you get a very different picture from that. 0345 6060 973. It's 10:31 on LBC News Headlines with Lucinda Horsley.
The first victim of the Swiss ski resort bar fire has been named as Italian teenager Emmanuel Gallopini. More than 40 people are presumed dead, with 115 injured. A chickenpox vaccine is being rolled out across the NHS for the first time. Children aged 12 to 18 months in the UK will now be offered the jab alongside the routine MMR vaccine. Amber warnings for heavy snow have been issued for parts of Scotland. The Met Office says the warnings will run from midday for 24 hours, with significant disruption possible. LBC weather, heavy snow showers across northern and northeast Scotland, clearer further south with sunshine, but cold with highs of 6 degrees.
LBC.
If you want all the best stories to tell, Best at Travel will provide the inspiration. For 40 years, our UK-based travel experts have been creating tailor-made luxury holidays. We are real people, passionate about making luxury travel personal, helping create your perfect trip. Secure your 2026 holiday today in the Best at Travel New Year sale. You can speak to one of our experts or book online at bestattravel.co.uk. Rated excellent on Trustpilot. Atoll protected.
It might be cold outside, but things are really warming up at the Wren Winter Sale, with red-hot prices on our high-quality, fully-built kitchens and fitted bedrooms. Right now, there's up to 60% off fully-built kitchens and all bedroom units.
plus up to 7 years interest-free credit. Made for making you feel warm inside, whatever the weather. Wren, made for living. Visit your nearest Wren showroom. Offers apply when you buy 5 or more kitchen units or 3 or more bedroom units. Finance subject to status and minimum spend.
But that makes gold. Then earns points on obscure vintage football shirts and cheesy chips before the match, and on tickets to the game. And you can put those points towards the cab home when they lose 4-0. And that's because Amex Gold lets you earn points on what you love and what you don't, to spend on things you like.
Representative 86.3% APR variable. Annual fee applies after the first year. Terms apply. 18 plus. Subject to approval.
At Kia, we have an award-winning range of electric cars for you to discover. From the compact SUV, the Kia EV3, and our latest hatchback, the Kia EV4, to our stylish new Kia EV5, the all-electric family SUV. Discover what driving electric really means. And if you order any Kia electric car by March 31st, you'll enjoy your first 2 services free. Search Discover Your Kia EV to book your test drive today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060973.
10:34 on LBC. Right, the texts are flooding in. Junior says, I don't think that... hang on, let me just put that into a larger typeface so I can read it properly. I don't think that people have the appetite for it. It's the same thing that is happening in the Congo. It's not on our doorstep, so we have this don't care attitude, and I'm all right, Jack. But not me. I'm all over the world for news, especially like what is happening in the Caribbean, as I'm from there. Well, good on you, Junior, because I think there is a sort of isolationist tendency now, I think, not just in this country, but certainly in America, where we think, well, if it isn't happening here, it's irrelevant to us. And it absolutely is not irrelevant to what's happening in this country. Iran has been an insidious cancer on this country for many, many years. That there are many, many killings carried out in Britain by the Iranian state. And that's not a conspiracy theory. There is actual evidence that this has happened. Zach says, here we go, Ian obsessed with Iran. Don't ever hear him talking about Sudan. Well, you haven't been listening properly, Zach, because I've done a couple of phone-ins on Sudan. I've done one on the war in the Congo. And I do these because I think it is important that even if you're not aware of what's going on in Sudan, then you ought to be. We ought to be across all of the major conflicts in all of the world. And yet we tend to concentrate only at the moment on Russia, Ukraine and Israel, Gaza. Both hugely important, and it's absolutely right that we cover those a lot. But we shouldn't ignore what's going on in the rest of the world. Goled is in Slough. Hello, Goled.
Oh, hi there. Hi, Ian. Good morning.
Hi.
So just to talk, on the whole Iran issue, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves. What happens next? So say for example, the regime falls, will there be peace and stability and secularism, or will it cause, you know, the region to inflame further? Will there be a new ISIS? Will it increase immigration? I'm not saying Iran isn't a problem, but it's contained, and I don't know what happens if the regime falls. We're encouraging something that we don't know the result of, essentially.
Well, it's a bit like Gaddafi in Libya, isn't it? I think most people wanted to see the back of Gaddafi for very obvious reasons. Now that was a case in point, and Iraq, you could say, also was when the regime fell. It was then up to the people of those countries to determine what happened next. And think back to, well, just let me finish and then you can respond. Think back to Libya. And the Libyans, after Gaddafi died, they actually said in terms to Barack Obama, David Cameron and Nicolas Sarkozy, leave it to us now. Which we did. And then it all fell apart.
Yeah.
So I can't sit here and say that, oh, a regime change in Iran would lead to a land flowing with milk and honey and immediate prosperity for the Iranian people. But I can't think it would be a lot worse than what's happening now.
It would be infinitely worse than what is happening now, Ian. It's a stable country. I don't think you're in it's very easy to throw these things around. And just to touch on the protests, they are protesting the finances of the country, which are crippled by sanctions. So this isn't necessarily the caller that mentioned a while ago. 95% of Iranians support the downfall of the regime. Based on what? What is he basing this on? I understand that he obviously has a very strong position. There's a lot of history around the revolution and the government that was sort of leading the country before that. There's a lot of support for them among some people, especially outside of Iran, from what I see. But I think we're getting ahead of ourselves. If the regime in Iran falls, it will be a disaster. It will be a disaster. And I know the countries in the region, they don't want to see stability in the region. I think Israel would benefit, and the United States would benefit, and the UK has long-standing issues with the Iranian regime. But I just don't think this is something that we've really thought about, and the fallout could be catastrophic.
How would you like to live under that regime?
I know people that do live under that regime. You don't have to. You can leave the country if you don't like it. This is the thing. There will be nations that don't live the way that we want to see them live. But we can't control every country. We can't sow discord.
Of course we can't, and nor should we even attempt to control other countries. I'm not in favour of that. What I am in favour of is people being able to live their lives without fear of repression from their own government, and having a secret service monitor their every move if they show any sign of dissent from the line. We wouldn't accept that in this country. No. So why should Iranians?
No, the Iranians shouldn't, but by and large, for a long time, they kind of have. And we're trying to nudge them in a different direction, which may be noble, but ultimately, it's down to them to determine how they run their country.
Totally agree.
Yeah. And I think we should just sort of step back and not encourage war and bloodshed.
Well, I'm not speaking in favour of Britain intervening in any way. I think we have seen enough examples of where we have intervened in ways which haven't been helpful, although you could also quote examples where we have intervened and it has been helpful. Sierra Leone, Kosovo, to name but two. However, I'm not arguing for that. What I am arguing for is that the world needs to sit up and take notice of what is happening in Iran, and then maybe if there is some sort of regime
it's all we've
change.
Heard for the last year, though, this is the thing. It's all there's been a war. You don't forget. I mean, Iran has been attacked. They're under threat of military action if they try to rebuild
that? Why is that, Golab? Because it's quite clear that Iran has been an insidious influence on most of the Middle East by funding Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, and many others. And a lot of Arab nations would like to see regime change in Iran, not just people in the West.
Well, the reason a lot of the Arab countries want to see regime change in Iran is because they're monarchies and they don't like the fact that Iran supports these popular resistance movements. They see that as a threat to them.
Commonly known as terrorist movements.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, I'm not defending Hamas or Hezbollah, but this is how it's viewed. This is the reality of the situation. But for Israel's existence, we probably wouldn't have Hamas or Hezbollah, and we wouldn't have the sort of funding that Iran provides. Israel absolutely has a right to exist, but you can't deny that it actually has.
That's a very weak argument. I understand why you make it, because a lot of other people have made it.
Well,
but
yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
the existence of the Houthis and the funding from Iran for the Houthis, that's got nothing to do with Israel.
I don't know a lot about that, I'll be honest with you, so I'll concede that point to you, but you can't deny that Israel has played a role in, and it's in its interest, really, to cause a bit of, it wants to reshape the region, and it claims that it's doing that for security.
I think you could also, I mean, whatever you say about Israel, I think it's very true that Iran wants to reshape the region as well. Gunnar, thank you very much. Let's go to Sean in Worthing. Hello, Sean.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to say?
Well, I was just moved to call your station, just listening to your previous caller. He absolutely has no idea. I'm sorry to say, he absolutely has no idea what he's talking about. I'm an Iranian. I've been living in this country for nearly 40 years. We had to actually escape the regime change, the revolution, when the Shah was overthrown and toppled by the current regime. And I can say with 100% certainty that as an Iranian, I know fully that probably more than 95% of people in Iran want a regime change. The only problem is they can't express this because when they do, they either get arrested, killed, their families get, they disappear. And it's, you know, young people in Iran are dying every day. But, and I want to commend you actually for bringing this to the conversation that the people aren't talking about this. And it's a very good question. Why aren't we talking about this? This is happening daily. It's been happening for a long time.
What's your answer to that question?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it depends what kind of a rabbit hole you want to go down, to be honest. You know, quite honestly, if we wanted to be talking about this, this would be headline news in the 6 o'clock news or whatever, but it's not. And there are reasons for this, and I don't know exactly why, but it's just not in the interest of whoever's controlling the media, put it that way, to bring this to the public attention
You see, I think that is a very simplistic way of looking at this because...
Possibly.
I mean, I've got somebody here that says, Ian, you're such a good boy. Just say what you're allowed to say by the accepted narrative and all else is propaganda. It should not be allowed to be said.
No,
pathetic.
I don't believe in that.
I'm not told to say
rubbish.
Anything.
That's rubbish. No, I totally agree. I don't think you are. And I don't think there's... But what I am saying is we should ask the question, why, for example, when, you know, the regime in Libya was overthrown, or why, for example, the regime in Iraq was overthrown, we were so interested in it as a nation. And it was everywhere in the news. It was headline news everywhere. And, you know, what's going on in Iran right now is 100 times worse than what was going on in Libya. And call it that Iran is a stable country and people can leave if they want to. That's absolute rubbish. It's not a stable country. There's so much going on there that we don't know about here because we're not presented with it in the 6 o'clock news. I know because I have connections in Iran. I have family in Iran. You know, we keep a close eye on what's going on there. And it's devastation. You know, people haven't got enough food. They haven't got electricity. They haven't got water. There's a massive water problem. Evacuating Iran, which is unthinkable, really. But we're not talking about that. And yes, there is an element of people are rising up against unemployment. They haven't got enough food to eat. So, but also, the regime is a murderous regime that is controlling people with an iron fist. If you say anything against the regime, you're literally taking your own life into your own hands. And, you know, people just say, oh, well, they can leave if they want to. That's rubbish. They can't. We can't just leave. Like, how can you get a visa to any other country if you're an Iranian? You can't.
Well, and also, you look at the case of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who is a British-Iranian dual national, who was imprisoned by the Iranian regime for no reason for, what, 5 years, was it? Many of you will have seen the TV drama of that in recent weeks. It's absolutely gripping and horrifying. And there are two British people in prison in Iran at the moment who've been held hostage, basically, since the beginning of January. That is not something that a non-repressive regime does. Sean, your line's giving out a bit, so we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Lots of calls coming in. We'll continue with them in just a moment. It's 10:46.
I'm James O'Brien. Thank you for listening to me on LBC throughout the year.
The independent sentencing review is good enough for everybody else, but what do you use instead?
Personal experience, lived experience. Listen, if they're the facts, they're the facts, but from my lived experience...
They're the facts, but I know better.
They don't understand culture of the UK.
So what is it?
When have I criticised...
But what is it? Why can't you tell me what it is? You're criticising people who don't know what the culture of the UK is, so you must be able to tell me.
I can't be asked, buddy. Have a good day.
That went well, didn't it, buddy? I'll be back next week, taking your calls on LBC.
I love visiting Mum and Dad, but as they've gotten older, I've worried about leaving them on their own, especially in winter. We visit as often as we can, but they needed more regular help. That's why we're so grateful to Ellie, their home instead care professional who lives with them and is always there when she's needed. It means Mum and Dad can stay in the home they love, and it gives us peace of mind to know they're okay when we're not there. For award-winning home care you can trust, visit homeinstead.co.uk.
The congestion charge helps to reduce traffic in central London. To ensure it remains effective while incentivising the switch to electric vehicles, electric cars will now be charged a 25% discounted rate of £13.50 rather than the new daily charge of £18. To receive the discount, electric cars must be registered on AutoPay. Further discounts are available for other electric vehicles. Search TfL AutoPay.
To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
At Lidl, we value getting you the most out of your money. Like switching from Tesco to Lidl and saving £32 on this week's big shop. See the savings at lidl.co.uk/you save and start the new year feeling like a savvy saver. Lidl, more to value. Prices check 10th of the 12th, 25. Tesco also sell other products. See online for more details.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
You know that guy I've been seeing?
Yeah.
Turns out my sister's been seeing him too.
Oh, really?
And I heard he's been seeing Kelly at number 56. And Dave.
Your brother?
Yep.
Specsavers opticians and audiologists own and run their stores. So your care is their business, which can make them rather popular.
I've got something to tell you. I've got half an hour with him this afternoon.
Specsavers. Your care is our business. Book an appointment today.
Ian Dale on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
10:49, Greg says, who would you tell you to say anything? You make every cause you care about sound clownish with your rubbish arguments. Bring back James. Well, James will be back on Monday from 10, Greg, so you've got your wish there. Sorry you think my arguments are clownish. I must do better, clearly. We're talking about Iran and what's going on in the protests in Iran and whether Donald Trump was right to issue this warning that he will intervene if the Iranian regime is violent towards the protesters. Shahab is in Highgate. Hello, Shahab.
Hello, good morning, Ian. It's morning. Nice to speak to you again. I have to say that the basic principle has to be the principle of consent. And that principle of consent to be ruled is absent and has been absent in Iran for a very, very long time. But this idea that that the West waves a stick every so often and threatens violence onto the regime and onto Iranians, I think is laughable and, in fact, probably counterproductive. It causes there to be even more violence in that cycle of violence that already pervades Iran. And I can speak from experience. I was caught up in the 2009 Green Wave protest movement, and I was imprisoned and tortured and then eventually released. There is no principle of justice in Iran. There is no due process that's followed. And that's what lies at the root of this problem, that people, because they're not being ruled by consent, because they're not actually in a participatory democracy, they're not going to actually make changes that stick. You can't go to the ballot box after 4 or 5 years of unhappiness and make a change that is tangible. So what needs to change is grassroots, from the grassroots of Iran. And yes, they do need support. But this idea that this great white hero in the White House is going to wave a wand or come over with his B-2s and do further damage to the Iranian infrastructure, and then suddenly everything will be all right, frankly, is laughable.
Well, to be fair, Donald Trump hasn't said that. He's just warned the Iranian regime that there could be consequences if they are violent towards protesters and shoot them.
Yeah, but, you know, this is a question of consistency, isn't it? Over so many years, there's been a lack of that. There is no idea of where Iran actually stands with any country. I take your point, by the way, about the violence that's done on these shores to Iranians by the Iranian regime. And the fact that this speaks to the point of consistency. Our government, for instance, has been very, very welcoming of those Iranians that actually are part and parcel of that problem. They have many homes in this country. They bring substantial wealth and spend it in this country. And the government has been nowhere to be seen when they've been doing that. They haven't clamped down on that. They haven't actually been there to say, no, actually, these people are on banned lists and shouldn't, by use of their proxies, be bringing their wealth and substituting it onto these shores and having a bolt hole from to which they could escape maybe in the future. There's a lot of inconsistency in the policy that we have towards Iran, and I think it's time that we actually made a clear statement of where we stand with Iran, what is acceptable and not acceptable, and what causes us then to detach ourselves completely. Obviously, Iran being a big oil producer, and obviously Iran being now in the camp of China and Russia, plays a large part in the attitude that
Interesting that you mentioned China and Russia there, because they're the dogs that haven't barked in this whole thing so far. Because I think if China made a public statement saying that, well, if the regime looked as if it was going to fall, they would come to its aid, I think that also would be a game changer. Shahab, thank you. Abdul's in South Woodford. Abdul, hi.
Hi there, Ian. Yeah, I think Shahab kind of made my point for me to an extent. I think, you know, the fact that they're having protests, etc., obviously an indication that something's wrong and people aren't happy. But, you know, my view is that any revolution, any uprising, it needs to be organic. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And, you know, a really good example of that, a recent example of that, is in Bangladesh. You know, you had a regime, a so-called democratic regime led by Sheikh Hasina. You know, they'd been in power for decades. But when things came to a head, it was an internal uprising, internal protests, student protests, all kinds of protests that basically brought down a regime. And that revolution now feels sustainable, because it was brought about by the people inside the country itself. And I think even statements that Donald Trump is making will tarnish any kind of uprising or anything that happens in the future, because you know what happens in the Middle East. Anytime there's any kind of, you know, a president from the West or a prime minister from the West making these kinds of statements, then it's, oh, this was instigated from the outside. This came from the outside. Right. So I think we need to be really careful. You might have a point, you know, maybe it needs more coverage and all that kind of stuff. But there should be no intervention, no language which suggests that this is something which is foreign led or comes from the outside. And just one final point, you know, a lot of callers are calling in Iranians about, you know, the state of the country, you know, how it's repressive and all that. Taken. I give that, right? But just ask them next time they call, what was life like under the Savak of the Shah of Iran? What was that like for people who disagreed with that regime? Just ask them that.
Mm. Well, but, and again,
you know, the Savak,
I'm certainly,
by the East Germans.
You're absolutely right on that, and I'm certainly not suggesting that life was hunky dory under the previous Shah, which is why when I hear the Crown Prince who is essentially saying that he would be willing to lead a temporary government, I'm not sure going back to the future is the future here. I'm not sure that would actually be very constructive, but very happy to hear other views on that. Abdul, thank you. Let's go to Halley, who's in Guildford. Hello, Halley.
Hi. I've come in a good time because I've got some answers from your previous caller's questions.
Go on then.
If I may start with that. I actually collect a lot of evidence about what's happening inside Iran right now. So I actually have evidence of two dead bodies on Lordegan, for example, yesterday. So I have been actually searching long and wide for Savak's evidence of all the crimes. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to actually locate an interview, a witness or someone who's actually gone through that. And I also have bought into that propaganda for years of my life. I was born in Iran and I've been in the UK since I was 15. So that's my answer to him, that I feel like Savak, the whole saga in it was a propaganda that was created by the Islamic Republic. So that's first thing. And if the Iranians see one way out and they're chanting on the streets, Reza Pahlavi or Pahlavi will return, then isn't that democracy to give them the chance to do what they want? They actually know the environment well. They're not stupid. Please don't speak over them. They know the environment. They know our history, and they are standing for it. So actually, people talking over them is not really helpful.
Well, I quite agree, and I do think any change has to come from within and not from outside. Because if it comes from outside, it could be very counterproductive.
Sure, exactly. But think about this. We have been trying to topple this regime for years. 3 years ago, we had wide protests. What we saw was crackdowns. We've had a new president since, been promising reforms. The reform ideology died in 2009. That's the problem. How do people topple it without anything and any kind of help? They will just continue to get killed. The analysis has been that over 2 million people will die based on a crackdown before this regime can be toppled. So how do you minimize those deaths? We don't want to promote any more deaths. We want to save the people. And how do we do it peacefully? In the case of South Africa, there was international pressure. There was international sanctions. We need a little bit more help than just, you know, even our political, even our political actions within the UK haven't really been stern, like your previous callers have mentioned. They've not been proper, and they've not stood straight where they stand with this situation.
Khalid, thank you very much indeed for rounding off our hour. Bizarre tweet, text of the day comes from Reza. Shame on you. You're supporting Islamists in Iran. I mean, quite how you can come to that conclusion after what I've said in this hour, I do not know. But there's always one, isn't there? Right, coming up in the next hour, we're going to turn our attention to a domestic issue because UK universities are extending career advice to graduates in their 40s and 50s. And that is because many people are experiencing career changes. Either it's forced on them or they've decided in their 40s and 50s to go down a different path. Is that you? Have you had a career change in your 40s, 50s or even 60s? I did in my 40s and I've never looked back. Best decision I ever made. But I wonder how AI is going to impact people now, because so many tasks in our economy are being taken over by AI that you may be forced to consider a career change in your 40s and 50s. Have you ever thought of that?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. The first victim of a fire at a Swiss ski resort, which has killed at least 40 people, has been identified as an Italian teenager. The Italian Golf Federation has paid tribute to Emmanuel Galapini. Around 100 other people are injured after flames ripped through a bar during New Year celebrations. Robert Stewart works for Cran Montana Tourism.
Obviously, there's a lot of people that are very concerned about their friends and their family, and that's going to take time, and I think it's too early to say, you know, what the future for those feelings holds. But right now, it's just about trying to process what's happened.
Switzerland is holding 5 days of national mourning. A man's been charged with murdering a 24-year-old just minutes before midnight on New Year's Eve. Police were called out to the Bury area of Greater Manchester at 5 to 12. A woman who was also arrested has been bailed. At least 7 people have been killed in Iran as protests over the economy spread to rural areas. Donald Trump has warned on Truth Social the United States is locked and loaded. The US president says he'll come to their rescue if peaceful protesters are violently targeted. Amber warnings for heavy snow have been issued for parts of Scotland. The Met Office says the warnings run from midday for 24 hours with significant travel disruption possible. Siobhan Murray's from the Highland 4x4 Response Charity. They've been deployed to drive NHS staff to their workplaces in heavy snow.
People's lives could be at risk if the correct services don't go ahead. And obviously, the Highlands is such a remote region that people get cut off quite easily. So we do provide a pretty essential service.
From today, a vaccine protecting against chickenpox is being rolled out on the NHS. Children across the UK will be offered the combined dose alongside the current MMR jab. Countries like Australia, the US and Canada have been handing it out for decades. In the city, the FTSE 100 has risen above 10,000 for the first time. A short time ago, it was trading up 38 points at 99.69. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, heavy snow showers across northern and northeast Scotland. Clearer further south with sunshine, but cold everywhere with highs of 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lucinda Horsley.
Turn ordinary into the extraordinary every day with the Lexus LBX. Whilst most SUVs are big and brash, the LBX is quietly bold and confident. Refined luxury crafted into a compact SUV. The Lexus LBX, what car's best small SUV 2024 and 2025.
Is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ian Dale.
Hello, a very good morning. It's 4 minutes past 11 on LBC. It's Ian Dale in for James O'Brien. For the last time this week, James will be back on Monday, and I'll be back in my normal evening slot on Monday, so all is right with the world. Now, growing numbers of institutions are now offering lifelong career support as older alumni seek help to change jobs. University careers advisors are used to steering fresh-faced students towards the labour market, but they're now increasingly seeing graduates in their 40s and 50s looking for help to revive their careers. More UK universities are now giving their graduates lifelong access to campus career services, including advice with job applications and interview preparations, as well as helping find new opportunities for those who feel stuck. Now, I think this is a really interesting move on the part of universities, because there was a time, probably when I graduated, where if you got a job with a large company, after you graduate, whether it's a law firm, a management consultancy, the kind of organisations that do the university milk round, you probably thought, well, that's a job for life. I won't ever have to look for another job again. Once I've gone through the initial training, assuming I pass that, I'll go through my 30s, 40s, 50s, retire in my 60s, job done. Now, our modern economy doesn't work like that, does it? It's very rare that people, I think, stay with the same company, certainly in their 20s. I moved around every couple of years. I think it's a good thing in your 20s to get lots of different experiences, maybe in the same sector. But it's very rare that people stay in that sector for their entire lives. My best friend at school, he got a job with Barclays when he left at 18. He decided university wasn't for him, and he retired in his late 50s, still with Barclays, and had a really good career, didn't ever feel the need to change. But I think that sort of thing is happening increasingly rarely. And the advent of AI, I think, is only ever going to increase, because we saw last year, figures released showed that the number of jobs on the university milk round, where all of these big companies go around the universities and recruit graduates, the number of jobs on offer fell in 1 year by 33%. Now, you draw a graph of that, and that's only ever going to get worse, isn't it? So where are the people going to go who are now in their 30s, 40s and 50s, who are in these jobs which are now threatened by AI? But there's a second aspect to this, isn't there? Because I think people often in their 40s and 50s think, well, I want a new challenge. I want to do something completely different. Maybe you've worked in the City of London. You've built up quite a good financial portfolio. You don't have to worry about money again. And you decide you're going to go and work for a charity. Now, I'm not saying this happens a lot, but I imagine there are plenty of people listening to this programme right now who have had a fairly dramatic change in their careers, either because it was forced on them or they just chose to do something else. Well, I think we'd all like to hear those experiences this morning, because they will be quite useful for people who may have to go through a career change, not of their own making, over the next few years. Why did you decide to do what you did? How did it work out? What challenges did you face from making a career change in your 40s, 50s, or even 60s? 0345 6060 973. Well, Martin Edmondson joins me. He's Chief Executive of the Association of Graduate Careers Advisory Services, which must have the most ugly acronym in the whole world, AGCAS. Now, they support careers and employability in higher education. You need to rebrand, Martin, frankly.
I think you might be right there, Ian, yeah.
So, are you noticing an increasing phenomenon of people deciding to make a dramatic career change, maybe midway through their careers?
Well, as you set out in your introduction, there's a much more fluid labour market now in general terms for everybody, whatever their age or stage of life. Whether it's because of AI or because of shifting roles or responsibilities in different industries. So we're certainly seeing our university members, we're an organisation made up of all the universities in the UK and Ireland. Our university members are increasingly creating a situation where they support graduates for life because those changes are happening at all sorts of different stages of life. So I think we've just seen, we've just got some new data that's coming out next week, which suggests that 45% of universities now offer lifetime support for graduates because they recognise that the relationship between a university and individual is a kind of lifetime contract. It's not just for the 3 years while someone studies anymore. It needs to reflect that whole change. And universities really take seriously both the development of people's education, clearly, because that's at the heart of what they do, but also how that then plays through into not just a single job, but if you like, a lifetime of careers, whatever those things are and however they evolve.
Do you agree with me that AI is going to be the game changer here? That, I mean, there have always been people in their 40s and 50s who've, for their own reasons, wanted to change their careers. But I think there's going to be this flood of people who are going to have to be forced to do it.
Yeah, I think there are. The AI is absolutely affecting jobs. I think clearly there's some fairly wild predictions at either end of the spectrum as to how it will change and remove jobs. There are some industries where I think we'll see jobs, you know, almost entirely replaced by AI. But I think in most cases, it's going to be about working alongside AI and how AI complements your role or your job, how it enhances it or how it helps you perhaps either be a bit more efficient or helps you fast track certain elements of your role. So I think depending on the industry you're in, AI will play a different role, but it's certainly being transformative. We're already seeing it evolving. For example, the nature of early careers roles in things like consulting that you mentioned earlier and the legal industry, where, you know, there are certain things that AI can do very quickly that it would have taken perhaps a group of people to do. But actually, there's still then a really important role for people alongside AI or AI in the loop, I think, as people describe it, as a kind of joint effort, if you like, to be more efficient, be more effective, speed up work, get to answers quicker, that kind of stuff. So I think there is definitely a pretty profound change taking place. Whether it's actually in a very binary way just taking jobs is less clear.
Are there particular sectors of the economy that tend to be, I don't know how to express this, the most prevalent for people to seek a career change from into something else? So, I mean, I imagine that it's mainly high-pressure jobs, maybe particularly in the City of London, where you spend 20 years and after, when you're in your mid-40s, you just feel burnt out and therefore think, well, I've built up quite a bit of money. I don't need to earn hundreds of thousands of pounds a year anymore. I'm going to go into mental health counselling or something that people might consider was less pressurised.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a route people take. And I think you're right about roles that perhaps people who've worked in. You talked about your friend earlier. I had a friend who worked in investment banking for 15, 20 years and then decided he wanted to go and run some pubs in Wales. So, you know, people do make some interesting kind of moves at different points and at different stages. I think what our university members are talking about people is sort of giving them a chance to step back from that and understand what they want out of life more holistically. I think that's one of the great things about sitting down with someone for some, you know, structured, proper careers advice is about thinking about the whole person, about everything you might want to do and achieve. So how might you balance? A friend of mine describes it as working, learning, playing and giving. Like, how might you get that mix of that right in your life? in a way that maybe earlier in your career you might have gone just full on for the sort of, as you said, the sort of really high intensity, perhaps high earning thing. You might later on think, oh, how do I balance out something that gives back a bit to society, helps me perhaps have better work-life balance as well. I think this is where universities with their careers teams are really keen to sit down and help people think through their options on that, as well as the really kind of like sometimes the practical stuff for people who've been in one role for a long time, haven't had an interview or haven't looked at their CV for a long time. So that's something that they might need some practical help with, as well as, if you like, the kind of more philosophical piece of thinking about, okay, what do I want to do with my life?
But have these university career services actually got the facilities to do this? Because I would have thought they're under enough pressure as it is with advising graduates on how to, recent graduates on how to get jobs, rather than thinking, okay, well, any graduate who's graduated from this university from the last 20 years will help you as well. I mean, that's going to increase their workload massively, surely.
Well, I think we've got to be realistic at the moment that universities are under the greatest financial pressure they've been for probably 30 years. So resources are tight in every part of a university right now. So clearly that's a challenge of things to balance. But I also think universities really take their responsibility seriously to the whole life chances of an individual who comes through their university system, if you see what I mean. So they're not just sort of saying, okay, you know, we've had you here for 3 years. That's the main time we support you. We see this as something, a relationship we have for life, and one where, and I think realistically what we're finding is that people aren't necessarily later in life dropping in all the time for sort of constant careers advice, but there are kind of key points where they want to make a change, and they might come in and sit down for a couple of conversations. And in that context, you know, the careers teams have got the capacity, and with a combination, I mean, you talk about AI again, many of our career services, yes, they use great careers advisors with kind of qualified advice for the more detailed conversations, but they're also really well equipped with digital tools now to help people like figure out how to make a great CV, how to do practice interviews using video interview software and things like that. So there's things like that that are pretty scalable, regardless of sort of, you know, what stage you're at in terms of trying to find a job.
Thank you very much indeed, Martin. That's Martin Edmondson there, Chief Executive of the Association of Graduate Careers Advisory Services. So is what we've been talking about something that you've had cause to think about, or maybe you've already gone through in changing careers? 0345 6060 973. Alan says, mental health counselling, less pressurised, FFS, you have no clue, Ian. As soon as I said that, I thought, idiot. Because I do recognise that mental health counselling is a pressurised job, but it's something totally different, I think. It's a different way of being challenged in your career. And as if by magic, John in Newton Williams says, after 30 years in anaesthesia, at the age of 63, I'm doing precisely what you just said. I'm studying to form a career in mental health counselling. And I've considered that myself, because when you become a radio presenter, which I did comparatively late in life at the age of 48, I never thought that I would still be here 15 years on. And I'm very grateful that I am. And I haven't had to make this decision about, okay, well, what do I do next? But I'm pretty sure that had I had to make that decision, I would have gone down the road of some form of counselling. Which would be very different. But in a sense, it isn't, because those of you that listen to my evening show will know that we do a lot of very sort of emotional issues, which do involve me sitting here, listening to people's problems and trying to help them go through them. And that there is a sort of counselling element to that, even though I've got absolutely no qualification in doing so. And it's something that I never thought when I joined LBC that I would do, or actually, if I did do it, be any good at. But I really enjoy that side of the job, talking about grief, depression, mental health. I think it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And so I could have foreseen myself going down that route. The other thing I've always said I would like to do is, and I did an hour on it not that long ago with two people from the charity Missing People, try and help people be found who've gone missing. Which, I mean, it's a niche thing, I suppose, but I would have really enjoyed doing that. And maybe I will do it in the future, who knows. Right, we'll come to your calls in a moment on career changes. What have been the challenges for you? Is it something that you're contemplating at the moment? It's 17 minutes past 11.
This is LBC.
The Famous Five are at home, and Julian could barely contain his excitement. "Why are you so excited?" asked George. "Is it your birthday? Is it snowing?" asked Dick. Are we having treacle sponge tonight? Asked Anne.
No, said Julian. It's the Great GWR Getaway Sale.
The Great GWR Getaway Sale is now on. Hurry, book before January 5th at gwr.com or on the app. Great Western Railway. Adventures start here. Terms apply. Selected routes only. Travel by April 10th.
But that makes gold. Then earns points on obscure vintage football shirts. And cheesy chips before the match. And on tickets to the game. And he can put those points towards the cab home when they lose 4-0. And that's because Amex Gold lets you earn points on what you love and what you don't to spend on things you like.
Representative 86.3% APR variable. Annual fee applies after the first year. Terms apply. 18 plus. Subject to approval.
At Kia, we have an award-winning range of electric cars for you to discover. From the compact SUV, the Kia EV3, and our latest hatchback, the Kia EV4, to our stylish new Kia EV5, the all-electric family SUV. Discover what driving electric really means. And if you order any Kia electric car by March 31st, you'll enjoy your first two services free. Search Discover Your Kia EV to book your test drive today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
T's and C's apply.
So, you're geared up for this making tax digital thing?
Sure, I just need some new mud boards, bag of cavity tyres and a couple of lintels.
Hey, MTD, mate, digital taxes.
Mm-hmm, it's an extension down Station Road on the corner.
Dave, digital taxes, mate.
Yeah, probably will need some 2x4s. I want to go to take the van in for a new fan belt, squeaky.
Hey, making tax digital, Dave.
Avoiding MTD. Sage makes tax simpler for sole traders. Search Sage MTD to get your free software today.
Ian Dale, text 84850. This is LBC.
90 minutes past 11. A friend of mine's just texted me who's changing career and wants to become a life coach and is undergoing the training. But I can't have him on because he's standing for local elections. So you can't do, if you're a candidate, you can't come on the radio, I'm afraid. Andy is in Hexham. Andy, hi.
Oh, hi. Hi. I've enjoyed listening to you this week, by the way.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Just a quickie. I was a senior project leader, software project leader for a big engineering company about 2002. I'd worked for them for about 22 years and took voluntary redundancy when the dot-com boom happened and the company went down the tube. Anyway, found myself voluntary redundant, took 6 months off work, and then found out I couldn't get another job at all. And there were no jobs in the industry, not a hope. So I discovered very quickly, if there's no one employing in your skill, you're an unskilled worker effectively trying to get a job.
Yeah.
So basically I looked around for a lot and it was just minimum wage jobs. So I retrained as a prison officer, which I did for 4 years. And that was a very different experience to what I've been doing for the 22 years before that.
And also, I mean, I don't know whether at this stage you were living in Hexham. I mean, Hexham is a beautiful town, but
I was living in Chelmsford at the time.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
That's quite a move from Chelmsford to Hexham.
But, yeah.
But the point I was making is that, I mean, if you live in a reasonably remote area, then maybe sort of there's not a diversity of positions available. And you then have to settle for something which is maybe second best that you didn't really want to do, but you need to have a job to exist. Well, and that can be quite challenging.
Yeah, well, I mean, my point of view, the reality was you went out and you got minimum pay jobs. That was all that was on offer if you went to the job centre.
Mm.
And the thing about being a prison officer was you did a training on it, but it was quite a bit above minimum wage and it was progressive, so your salary went up over the first few years quite a lot. So it made it viable, economically viable to do. But it wasn't a job that I would have picked, you know, had the option to be in my original career. But having said that, it was quite a life experience. And I must admit, I really got a lot out of doing it for 4 or 5 years.
You're not doing it at the moment?
No, I did. I did 5 years at it. And then after 5 years, my original employers phoned me up and there was a job opportunity had come up and they'd remembered me and they offered me that job and I did that for the last 8 years before I retired. So I went back to what I'd done originally.
Which is interesting, isn't it? And do you have any regrets about doing that?
Absolutely none. I mean, to be honest, being in the prison service was very, very different. And I'll be frank about this. When I went to do the training was extremely good. But after my first week of training, the two guys that did it, who were guys that basically worked 6 months of the year, you know, in the job and then did 6 months training. They took me into a room at the bank and had a chat with me after the first week and said, we think you can do this job. We think you'll get through the training. But we want you to know that because of the background you're from, it's going to be very difficult for you because you're going to find it very difficult being accepted for the first year or so because you're not a natural male, the sort of person that does this job normally. And we're just warning you about this before you go ahead. And they were absolutely right. The first year was awful. And then after that, I sort of got more used to it, integrated in. And by the time I got to my third or fourth year, it was fine. But it can be very challenging going from one environment to a completely different environment, if you know what I mean by that. And there's just, yeah, but having said that, you know, I did enjoy it. And looking back on it, I'm really glad that I did it.
Well, it all worked out for you. What can be better?
Yeah, I don't quite know how universities would help with this when you're 25 years downstream. Because you've been doing a job for 25 years since you graduated. If the options out there is to do something completely different, I'm not quite sure how a university faculty from 25 years ago would help you with that. But, yeah.
Well, and they have to spend time getting to know you because, I mean, I remember from my time at university, I would often go into the career service building, have a little chat with them, and they got to know me. And now, in the end, I didn't need their services. I got a job through my own efforts. But I think to have a whole cadre of new people wanting advice when they haven't really got a clue who you are, what you've done, what you want to do. I mean, as I say, I think the amount of time that would take up would be massive. Andy, thank you. Let's go to Simon in St Helens. Hi, Simon.
Good morning, Ian, and thanks very much for all the great work over the festive period.
You're very kind.
Well, no, I did exactly what you're discussing this morning. I was 37 years old when I changed career. And it did not go the way I'd expected because I was working at sea as an engineer and I was a marine engineer and I had quite a good career. And I'd done 12 years at sea and thought I'd like to come ashore now and, you know, get some normality in life because you miss so much when you work away all the time. And I come with sort of the maybe naive expectation that I'd go into engineering again, shoreside. But what I discovered is the qualifications didn't really translate from marine to shore. And I was applying for jobs I could do with my eyes shut and not getting interviewed. So all of a sudden I thought, right, I'm going to have to start a new career in something completely different, which was stressful.
So what did you do?
Well, for the first few years, I scrapped around sort of doing things I didn't particularly want to do, but it kept me in work. Funnily enough, I did a spell as what your previous caller was just discussing as well as a prison officer. But I couldn't deal with that because the people in the prison service are some of the best people I've ever met and worked with, but the way the job was ran, I found to be a shambles. You were just up against it with your employers all the time. But in the end, I got a job working for a major bank, which was really daunting because I'd always worked with sort of tools and hammers and spanners and stuff. Didn't know how to use a computer, and I've just had to learn.
What were the challenges?
Well, for example, I was really lucky as well because there was two jobs available at the same time that I was considering, and one was running a pub. But this was literally like weeks before COVID happened, and the pub I was talking to the pub company about was shut down for 2 years. So, but what I was thinking about, I'll tell you the challenges as well, but I was thinking about if I'm starting a career from scratch and I've got to go in at the bottom ladder, then this would be my tip, is think about longevity and getting yourself in somewhere where there is actually progression and you can see what your next steps might be. But in terms of challenges, I remember day one, because I started in the call centre for the bank. So you're going on have a tour around the building. And I was looking at people who were at a computer with headsets on, taking calls from customers, using computer systems to help the customer also answer an email while they're doing it all at the same time. And I nearly walked out then, because I didn't really use the computer much. I thought, there's no way I can do this, but I talked myself into staying and persevered, and I've had a couple of promotions and not doing so bad now.
I think that is a temptation, isn't it? When you go into a job, and almost on your first day or in your first week, you think, oh, I'm not sure I like this, don't think this is going to work out. You do have to sometimes force yourself to persevere, don't you?
Yeah, and it wasn't even so much of thinking I might not fancy the work, but real self-doubt about having any capability to be able to do what these people are doing, but realistically, if you are going to change career, the fact of the matter is you are going to be out of your comfort zone, so you've got to just make yourself do it.
I don't know if this is your experience, but my experience certainly has been when I've got a new job, I almost know on my first day whether I like it or not and whether it's going to work out. And the only job that I've ever had that I really didn't enjoy, and I resigned after 3 months, it was with a PR company, I knew on my first day that it wasn't for me. I let it go for a time, but in the end, I had no job to go to. And I really, when I resigned, I knew I was doing the right thing in many ways, but there was that part of me that thought, well, you idiot, you've got a mortgage to pay. You can't really afford not to have a job. And yet you've now put yourself in a position where you haven't got one.
Yeah, and that switched from seafaring to coming ashore is the only time I've done that, because realistically, you've sort of got to do, you'd have to come ashore and be unemployed till you find your next thing in previous jobs, and even that period in between, because that was 2017 to now, when I did a few years where I did various jobs. Even if I absolutely hated it, and I do agree with you, you get a sense on day one whether you're comfortable there or whether you've made a real mess up. I nearly swore by accident and a mess up. Even then, I would not... Even if it was making me miserable, I would not get out of that job until the next one was lined up, because you've got to work and you've got to pay them bills.
Yeah. And so what are you doing now?
Still at the bank that I went for. Just coming up 6 years ago. But like I say, I've had a couple of progressions with them. Hopefully a few more to come, because I've got about 20 years till I get to retire. And, well, we'll see how that goes, but hopefully about 20 years. So I'm still with them. And, you know, I could have walked home on day one, but actually I'm dead happy there now.
And you can't imagine in the next 20 years you having another career change. You think you're set now?
No, this has got to be it now, because you've also got to think about your private pension as well, isn't it? So I'm intending to change jobs a few times within the organisation, get a couple more promotions under the belt. But you know, I'm 45 now, and I came ashore at 37. You've got to think about, you know, some consistency and getting the money into that private pension when retirement comes, because I'm increasing it by a certain percentage every year to get ready for that.
Okay, Simon, thank you very much indeed. I think Simon's experience is probably fairly typical of many. Let's run through a couple of texts before we go to the news. Nick says, salaries are very low. I'm a qualified RICS surveyor. I was made redundant last year and haven't managed to return to the workplace. Well, I wonder whether, Nick, you're thinking you might have to change career in order to return to the workplace. Wesley says, as a lead practitioner at school, one of my roles involves training new PGCE teachers. That's Postgraduate Certificate of Education teachers. I had a 62-year-old last term, and she knows that she only has 5 years of working left, but has decided to take student finance to retrain to teach. She's so eager, and I wish I had younger people be so enthusiastic. See, that is, again, originally, when I went to university, I intended to be a German teacher. It's never happened for all sorts of different reasons. But I have thought from time to time, well, if everything doesn't work out in my current career, then should I think about going back to teaching? I'm not going to now, because I think I've got to 63. I think that is probably a little late. But then again, Wesley, you've got someone who's 62 who is doing it. Keep your calls coming on career changes, 0345 6060 973. It's 11:31 on LBC News Headlines with Lucinda Horsley.
The first victim of a fire at a Swiss ski resort, which killed more than 40 people, has been identified as an Italian teenager. The Italian Golf Federation has paid tribute to Emanuele Galapini. Around 100 people are also badly injured after flames ripped through a bar during New Year celebrations. A man's been charged with murdering a 24-year-old just minutes before midnight on New Year's Eve in Greater Manchester. Police were called out to the Bury area at 5 to 12. From today, a vaccine protecting against chickenpox is being rolled out on the NHS. Children across the UK will be offered the combined dose alongside the current MMR jab. LBC weather, heavy snow showers across northern Scotland today. Clearer further south with sunshine, highs of 6 degrees.
This is LBC.
EasyJet's Big Orange Sale is now on. New year, new plans, new deals. With up to £400 off package holidays and up to 20% off flights. EasyJet, get out there. Selected dates and flights. Flight sale ends 3rd of Feb, holiday sale ends 3rd of March. Min spend and ATL protected. T's and C's apply.
The famous five are at home and Julian could barely contain his excitement.
Why are you so excited? Asked George. Is it your birthday?
Is it snowing? Asked Dick. Are we having treacle sponge tonight? Asked Anne. No, said Julian. It's the Great GWR Getaway Sale.
The Great GWR Getaway Sale is now on. Hurry, book before January 5th at gwr.com or on the app. Great Western Railway. Adventures start here. Terms apply. Selected routes only. Travel by April 10th.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 991234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the journalism industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Molly, a journalism student in Year 12.
Outside of the classroom, we run our own news platform called The Loop. I do a daily news bulletin and produce videos for socials. We learn everything we need to be a journalist and have even learned alongside the news team at Global.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in Years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Ian Dale on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
11:34, we're talking about the fact that UK universities are extending their careers advice services to graduates in their 40s and 50s. And we're asking, have you had a late career change? Has it been forced on you? Do you fear that the advent of AI means that over the next few years that you may well, in your particular job, face this challenge of having to find a new career? Becky says, this is a nice, reassuring and motivating hour. How many times can people say that? I have two young kids and a mortgage. I feel completely unchallenged at my job. I'm eager for a career change, but I know for now my focus has to be on the family. It's nice hearing people change careers later in life. Well, I think it is, because it proves that it can be done. And I think in your situation, Becky, I think you're making exactly the right decision. You have to put your young family first. But I wonder, I don't know how old your kids are, but I wonder how many parents really fear for the employment prospects of their children later in their lives, because the employment market is going to become far more challenging than it is now. We have an unemployment rate. I mean, it's gone up from 4% to 5% in the last year. I think it'll go up to 6% by the end of 2026. And I'm afraid, I think over the next 10 or 20 years, higher unemployment is going to be a constant fixture of our economy. And I think that is going to be incredibly challenging, particularly for people with young families, because if you haven't got a meaningful job with a meaningful salary, how on earth can then you afford to have children? I think that is something that governments over the next 20 years are going to have to recognise. Let's go to Carol, who's in Chigwell. Hello, Carol.
Well, good morning, Mr. Dale. Morning. Happy New Year.
You can call me Ian if you like.
Thank you, Ian. thank you, Ian. Happy New Year. I will be very brief. This topic has piqued my interest because I'm 75, and when I was 50, I was working in local government in Essex, and there were changes at the top, and I feared for my job. I was living on my own, and I thought, I have a mortgage, etc. So I retrained as a counsellor. 7 years, and I am having the most wonderful career, which will never end until I think I shuffle off this mortal coil, because it gives me so much. I work with neurodiversity, I work with couples, I work with addictions. I've had a wonderful career, which I'm still having. So my message is, it is never, ever too late to reassess your life and look at what you want to do, not where you are right now.
It says here, and I can't remember, did you say this in your opening remarks, you're 75?
I'm 75, yes.
You sound a very young 75, if I may say so.
Oh, Ian, I'm calling you Ian now. Thank you. No, I think, you know what it is, actually, it's if you have a zest for what you do and a zest for life.
Yes, exactly.
You never feel, get, and have the sense of being old. And I'm not. I don't think I am. It's how you present yourself and how you go out into the world and what you want to do.
I've just finished writing my autobiography, and it's when you do that, it's a real time for reflection.
Isn't
and
it?
You look back at all the different jobs that you've had, and I can truly say that doing this job now, it's what I was put on this earth to do. And I don't think anyone can ask for any more than that, to have the job that they know that they were meant to do. And I get from your enthusiasm, you feel exactly the same way about what you do.
Ian, I concur, and I cannot wait for your book to come out, actually, because, you know, I'm not fawning, but I do listen to you. I don't always agree with you. Very often I don't. But I have a healthy respect for your perception of the topics that you put out on the radio, and want to thank you because you give me lots of enjoyment when I listen to you.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, God, this sounds a valedictory programme. Well, I suppose it is in a way, because it's my last one at 10 o'clock in the morning. Carol, what a lovely lady. Thank you. Derwin says, in terms of career changes, Ian, have you given up on becoming an MP? Because you may remember I had a little flirtation with that last year, which didn't end well. Yes is the answer to that. I feel that I'm too old to do that ever again, and I shouldn't have done it last time, because I was only given 48 hours to make a decision, and I made the wrong decision. Simple as that. Anne is in Hinckley. Hello, Anne.
Hello there.
Hi.
I'm 59 years old. At age 47, I gave up working in sales mostly and became a nurse. I then got involved in local politics, stood as a local councillor, and then as a county councillor. And I am absolutely ecstatic with my decisions. I think it was the best thing I ever did. And strangely enough, my other half retrained as from being a welder into being a beekeeper.
Now that is quite a change, isn't it?
It is. It's a huge change, isn't it?
had you always had bees?
No, about 15 years ago, I bought him a bee experience, as it were, and he loved it, so he started it as a hobby.
What on earth prompted you to do that?
Well, we're both into the countryside, we both enjoy nature, and it was just a, let's get something different for him. And he now works for a company as a beekeeper, as well as keeping his own bees.
And he feels that he's landed on his feet, that this is exactly where he should have maybe started, maybe.
Absolutely, I think. I think he enjoyed welding, and he still does a little bit of welding here and there on odd bits and pieces. But beekeeping is him. He eats, sleeps and breathes beekeeping. So I go one way, he goes the other.
My Uncle John, who was a beekeeper in North Devon, in Braunton, and he would be called upon by everyone around the community. If they had a bee problem or a beehive they found in their attic or something, he was the one that they would go to. And I wouldn't say he was in love with bees, that sounds a bit ridiculous, but he was an absolute bee lover, which it sounds as if your husband is.
He's now chair of Nuneaton Beekeepers, and he will dash out and have a look at bees for people all over the place. In fact, he talks bees morning, noon and night. He reads about bees. He watches bees videos. That's what he does. He loves it.
Watches bees videos. Now there's a thought. I didn't even know they I didn't even know they existed. Look, everything exists now on YouTube, doesn't it? And what a great call. Thank you very much indeed. Terry in Bournemouth says, good morning, Ian. I'm all for universities helping people through their lives with career changes. I believe it's very important to have a portfolio of skills, both practical and academic. I left school and became an electrician, then university to train as a drama teacher, singer, and then engineering manager, and have currently gone into teaching youngsters how to become electricians. We don't know what the future holds, but let's all get armed with a diverse range of skills. Great job over the holidays, says Terry. Thank you very much indeed. Let's go to Ned in Cambridge. Hello, Ned.
Morning, Ian. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well. Really enjoying this phone-in, actually. I think there have been some fantastic stories.
It's brilliant. And hopefully I can you know, do some good work and contribute to it too. So I do find myself in the very position that you posit. I've just lost my role end of November. I'm 53 and I'm moved up to Cambridge to be up with my mum, see if I can get some temp work just to kind of keep me ticking on while I ponder what to do. And I'm kind of intrigued about the university thing, obviously being in Cambridge and things. But I think I'd like possibly employers to do a bit more on this. I mean, I've been in the work market and I worked in recruitment as well in the city for a long time, been a hiring manager, so I do understand how people get hired and why. And it seems to me the job market in this country only works if you're between 25 and 40. You either can't get on the ladder for love nor money, or you're seen as a bit over the hill at 40, or you might be sort of being pushed into management. And management is not for everyone, Ian. You know, not everyone's a good manager. Some people just like getting on with the job that they do. So you find it's very sort of like a pyramid at a certain point. So I'm pondering what to do myself. I love the industry that I'm in, but the issue that I have with this is, and you'll see this actually, this is kind of a lot of the reason for the churn in the job market, is we have a lot of private equity buying and selling companies these days, and they work on a 5-year cycle. So if you find yourself in a job interview saying, well, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time, you might find yourself out of another job again or looking again because that company's now been sold and you're back on the market. So that makes me uneasy at my age because I don't want to have to keep looking for a job again, you know, every sort of 3, 4, 5 years, you know. So what to do? So I would like it if employers would be less risk averse and more focused on sort of training and bringing in people potentially from other sectors, because it's very difficult to change your lane. You'll have callers ring and say, I'll apply for 600 jobs, I haven't got a single thing. And this has really happened since the financial crash 2008, I noticed in the recruitment market, is that employers will only take people essentially that work for their competition or sit swim in their pond. They're very difficult if I want to go for work from an IT firm, for a law firm. And I work in sales, and that's, you'd think, the most transferable thing. But they only really want people that they don't have to train, hit the ground running. So that would be useful. And also, I wish they bring temp work back in. I can't get even a minimum wage job here, because you used to sort of walk down the high street and walk into a Deco or Reed or Hayes or someone, they say, yeah, great, well, what have you got, you know, can you turn up tomorrow? And it just doesn't seem to exist anymore. Everything's apply on the website and we'll come back to you if we've got anything for you, and there's just nothing there.
And that's really interesting, because in Cambridge, well, I was born in Cambridge, I grew up not far away, and the Cambridge local economy is absolutely booming, isn't it? So you think, well, if you can't get a job, an adequate job in Cambridge, then what is it like in an area which is very depressed?
Well, this is, I mean, I live sort of North Essex, normally just down the road from Harwich and what have you. So unless you're a special needs SEN teacher or a forklift driver, that's the only thing that was available. So I came up here. So it's going to open up a little bit, I hope, but I've just got a rejection. I think it was for a customer service job up the road that I could have done, you know, quite easily, quite happily, just while I, you know, work out what it is I want to do. Temping, and they just say, oh, well, you know, we don't think you're right at this time for this role. And I was thinking, yeah, but, you know, you need to let up a little bit here, lads. You know,
well,
you
can't it's that usual thing of, oh, you're overqualified.
Overqualified, yeah. Or underqualified, or, you know, and they're constantly looking for this sort of, I mean, the thing that, the problem is, you know, people leave jobs because they've had enough of the, maybe the market, the industry or something, and employers still want to employ you into the same job you were doing, but for a different company. And I think that's really killing our mindset as well, because people don't want to, they want to grow, they want to do something different, they want to learn new skills and train and do things. And it's very difficult to do, you know, to find something else, unless you go to some huge retraining, like your callers said, but I can't imagine myself doing 7 years to become a counsellor. I, you know, I need to pay the mortgage now, you know? So that was my 2 pence, anyway.
And it was well spent. Thank you very much indeed, Ned. Now, you'll have been hearing in the news bulletins the fact that the FTSE has broken the 10,000 mark for the first time. My first reaction to that is, well, how is this possible? Given the state of the economy, why is the FTSE booming? And it has been all year. Well, we're going to find out in just a few minutes' time, and we'll take more calls on career changes. It's 11:46.
This is LBC.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature, biotiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Beautiful Gut Health. Upgrade your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and reset your gut health with Beautiful. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see beautifulguthealth.com/radio.
The following is from TfL.
I got loads of flowers the other day and messages from people I didn't even know. My mates spelled my name in tea lights and my mom hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings next to the lamppost where I got killed by a nice lady, just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Find me somebody to love.
It's your last chance to save big in the Dream Sale, with up to 40% off. Anything to add, Beds?
Oh, I do. It all ends on Tuesday, so don't get caught napping.
All good springs must come to an end.
Dreams. Love your bed.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
Cross Question with Ian Dale.
Now you're saying that doctors going on strike because they want more pay is a disgrace. I think you need, Andrew, a lesson in what is a disgrace.
Monday to Thursday from 8 p.m.
What you demonstrate is the lack of understanding as to how farming is financed.
Listen and watch on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
If you choose to not work and not get educated these days, you end up getting paid by everybody else.
Cross Question.
Welcome to Monday's Cross Question with me, Ian Dale. On the panel tonight,
only on LBC. Ian Dale on LBC.
Yes, from next week, Cross Question is going four nights a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, between 8 and 9. If you've never listened to it, it's become a bit of a cult listening for some people. We have four people, generally two from the left, two from the right, politicians, historians, academics, journalists, those people that you will recognise, and they battle it out. And we try and have an intelligent discussion rather than just have a row, which some of these panel programmes specialise in. Anyway, if you haven't ever listened to it, I hope you'll tune in next week. But I am, of course, on from 7. Let's find out why the FTSE is breaking records at the moment, because it's a little bit of a mystery to me. Let's talk to Dan Coatsworth. He's head of markets at the stockbroker AJ Bell. Dan, very good morning to you. Now, it's broken 10,000 for the first time. I can remember when it was like 3,000, 4,000. And it's been a very good year for the UK stock market. But why, given that the economy is rather floundering?
Well, key thing to think about here is the FTSE 100 is the 100 biggest companies on the UK stock market. But about three quarters of their earnings actually come from overseas. So this isn't really a straight play on the UK economy. There's lots of reasons why these companies have done well. You know, in 2025, FTSE 100 had its fifth best ever year. And what was driving that was interest in mining stocks because the gold and silver price went up. Defence stocks like BAE Systems and Rolls-Royce. There's more money going to be spent by governments in various parts of the world on defence. We also had just interest in banks. You know, people think about banks being really boring, but actually they did a really good job from a business perspective in 2025, and banking shares did incredibly well. And then I just think people look at places like the US, not quite sure about some of the policies that are being followed by the current president, and they're looking at other parts of the world thinking, okay, maybe I need to just diversify where I hold my money. The UK stock market is much cheaper than America. And you've got the types of companies that could do well, whether the economy is doing well or bad. And you're thinking things like utility companies, tobacco companies, insurance companies. These are, you know, they're pretty boring in terms of what they do from a day-to-day business. But, you know, they just keep generating money over and over again. And I think that we've just seen a year where people look at these areas of the stock market and go, actually, it's not bad if I perhaps want to think about having some of these things. And so brilliant year for the FTSE 100 and the UK stock market in 2025. The year's just now started in 2026, and people just started the year in pretty good mood. And so that's pushed that market up beyond 10,000 for the first time.
And what about the FTSE 250, which is more sort of smaller British companies, isn't it?
Yeah, that's about half of its earnings come from the UK. So typically here you might see, it's a much broader mixture of stuff. There's actually quite a lot of house builders in there. So if you look at kind of what's going on in the world, you know, the UK government wants more houses built. But interest rates are still quite high. So there's sort of mixed messages there. But yeah, you've got a more broader range of stuff. Quite a lot of retail companies in there as well. So if you think that consumers are kind of still watching their spending quite closely, so FTSE 250 sort of lagging behind a bit, but you know the real excitement today is all about the FTSE 100 and these 100 big companies that you see on the market.
Now Dan, we're talking about career changes. I'm not suggesting that you need one, but have you had one, and have you ever thought about having one?
Oh, a career change. That's a very interesting comment. I don't tell you, my wife is going through this very thought process at the moment, partially to do with disruption in the industry where she works. And so, I think that, you know, I always think it's never too late to think about a career change. If you've got a bright idea, you think, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do it. I would really encourage it.
Absolutely. Dan, Happy New Year. Thank you very much indeed. That's Dan Coatsworth, the head of markets at the stockbroker AJ Bell. Ben says, I run a CIC. I have to say, what is a CIC? Anybody know behind the glass? That provides essential digital skills for people across Staffordshire and the country. We are now seeing more and more people access our services who are about to be made redundant and need to upskill. A recent example of this is Moorcroft Pottery, one of the oldest in Stoke. And when it went into receivership, you had all the workforce out looking for work. Some of these ladies have been in that work for over 45 years. So when they asked to fill in redundancy forms online, these women didn't even have an email address, let alone the skills to complete the forms. AI is only going to cause this to increase. Well, that's slightly depressing. Phil is from a place in Cornwall that if I try to pronounce, I might lose my job. Phil, can you pronounce it yourself, please?
Hi, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
FEOC.
FEOC. Thank goodness you've said the right pronunciation. What would you like to say?
Listening to your show. It's been very refreshing this week. Been great listening. What you described in terms of a career in finance or in the city was actually my situation. And we got to just before COVID, and between I got the wrong side, unfortunately, of a bit of a pension scandal, and then COVID hit, and it was the trigger to realize that I was going to have to sort of reinvent myself and go for a second career change. And ended up looking for small businesses that I thought I might be able to run, and ended up buying a very small marine business, deepest West Cornwall on the Helford River, operating the oldest passenger ferry crossing in the UK.
Oh, wow. How did you come across that?
It was advertised, and it had a number of potential buyers look at it and not pull the trigger. I think with anybody looking at a sort of career change, and it's a bit of a leap of faith. And I think circumstances dictated that at the time that I take that leap of faith, and it turned out probably to be one of the best things I ever did in terms of lifestyle and challenge. The challenge now, of course, like any small business struggling in this environment, is to stay afloat. That is the current challenge. But everything else about it, in terms of meeting people from all walks of life, people from many different countries who come to walk the Southwest Coast Path and enjoy the beautiful surroundings, it's been fantastic for myself, my wife, and my daughter.
And is it something where you think, well, I can never imagine changing now? This is what I am going to be doing for the rest of my working life.
It absolutely is. I mean, I actually was living in Tunbridge Wells, as it happens, when we took this decision. And now I can't almost envisage moving east of Exeter. every time I should have
be,
come.
That would be a brilliant there. Film title, East of Exeter.
Well, it's the closest thing to possibly living in the 70s and 80s down here. You know, we are very far west. The pace of life is slower. You know, salaries obviously are also lower. And that's a struggle for a county which obviously relies very heavily on tourism and farming. So for all small businesses, it is a case of just hang on tight and try and hope that we get decent weather and we get an economy that starts to turn the corner.
I think the point you make about pace of life is a really interesting one, because as my uncle and his family, he's sadly passed away now, but they live in Braunton in North Devon, and I go and visit them at least, well, hopefully once a year. And I also am a patron of the Foy Literary Festival, and whenever I go down there each May, I constantly think, oh, this is such a lovely area, the pace of life, it's a totally different atmosphere. I could really happily live in a place like this. And then I go back to my life in London and the South East. But one day, Phil, one day.
Yeah, well, I never rule it out, Ian, because I think, you know, I was 60 when I took that decision. And it's something I'm not regretting. And as I said, just got to hang on. Wait for better times, but I think if I had the choice to take that decision again, and if someone asked me whether I'd make the same decision, 100% every time.
Well, it doesn't get better than that. I think there are plenty of people around who probably made a decision that they live to regret, but we've only heard the positive side in this hour, and thank you to all the callers for that. David says, I had a great 20 years in record labels and music until my early 40s. Then I started an estate agency. One lot of sharks to another. It was a great choice. Well, I'll take your word for that, David. Being an estate agent, that's not something I've ever fancied doing, because I think you are at the whim of the property market. And let's face it, due to all sorts of reasons, the property market is not probably going to be very vibrant over the course of the next 12 months. Right, coming up in a moment, the decline in reading is a threat to British national security, believe it or not. That's according to the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson. She says it leaves children more vulnerable to Russian disinformation. Now, she's written an article in The Telegraph to sound the alarm over the stark fall in the number of younger people picking up books for pleasure. Just 33% of children aged over 8 say they enjoy reading in their free time, according to the National Literacy Trust, down from 51% 2 decades ago. Now, that is quite a dramatic fall. Have you noticed this among your own children, that they just don't pick up books in the same way that you used to? How can people be encouraged to read more? 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday. The first victim of at least 40 people killed in a fire at a Swiss ski resort has been named as Italian teen golfer Emmanuel Galapini. Flames tore through a basement bar in Cron, Montana during New Year celebrations, leaving more than 100 injured. The cause is still unknown, but witnesses reported seeing sparklers shortly before the flames took hold. Fire safety expert Steve Dudney says the fact the fire started on a lower floor would have seriously hindered escape.
With a basement, you have to go through that heat barrier, which is going to be up to about 1200 degrees, which might explain people's inability to get out, even if there was enough escape routes, because they've got to go through an almost impenetrable barrier.
A man's been charged with murder following the death of a 24-year-old man in Bury in Greater Manchester on New Year's Eve. Police say 25-year-old Anthony Junior Murray is also charged with possession of a bladed article. He's due in court today. Russian authorities say the number of people killed in a drone strike which hit a cafe in a Russian-occupied village in Ukraine has risen to 27. Kiev denies attacking civilians after Moscow reported a strike in the Kherson region on New Year's Eve. The health secretary is insisting vaccines are safe, tested and tried, as children are offered a free chickenpox jab. It's being rolled out on the NHS for the first time. Stephanie Tingley, a nurse at Great Ormond Street Hospital, says it's great news.
Families that are worried about their children going to school because of catching chickenpox, because it can make them really unwell. As a previous intensive care nurse, I've seen children that have been hospitalised because of it. And if we can do anything to reduce the effects of chickenpox, I think it's brilliant.
And Brighton's Palace Pier's been put up for sale after struggling with visitor numbers and rising costs. Owner Brighton Pier Group says the sale of the near 127-year-old landmark is being made to return capital to shareholders. In the city, the FTSE 100 rose above 10,000 for the first time earlier. A short time ago, it was trading up 47 points at 99.77. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, heavy snow showers across northern and northeast Scotland today. Clearer further south with sunshine. Cold everywhere with highs of 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lucinda Horsley.
Hello, you've reached the voicemail of Holiday Rebecca. She's a bit like work Rebecca, except her stress headache is gone. Her frown lines have faded, and instead of hunching over a desk with a meal deal, she's enjoying fresh, hand-rolled pasta for lunch. If you require work Rebecca, please try again in about 10 days.
Take your holiday seriously. British Airways Holidays. Atoll protected.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ian Dale.
Hello, very good afternoon. 3 minutes past 12 on LBC. It's Ian Dale in for James O'Brien. James is back on Monday from 10. Now, I want to talk about reading because I, as a child, loved reading. I spent hours and hours predominantly reading Enid Blyton, if I'm honest. The Secret of Spiggy Holes, The Faraway Magic Tree, and all sorts of things like that. And I can remember the joy that I would get out of these books because they would... And I came across one of them recently, The Magic Faraway Tree, and I started reading it again, and it just took me back to my childhood at the age of, I don't know, six, seven, eight. And I instantly recalled the imagination that I would sort of read the words, and instantly the scene was created in my mind. And it started a lifelong love of reading, really. But then I thought to myself, I'm not reading as much as I used to. I'm certainly not reading novels. I used to read a lot of novels. I can't remember the last time I read a novel. Because I have to read a lot to do my job. So reading for pleasure is something that I've almost lost the art of doing. I'm reading Jo Cole's autobiography at the moment. Now, I suppose that you can class as reading for pleasure. Footballer, I mean. But I'm also reading Tim Shipman's fourth volume of his Brexit books, 1,200 pages. I've been reading it literally for 9 months and I'm still only about halfway through it. So I don't have a lot of time to read. But in a sense, does that matter? Because obviously back in the day, the internet didn't exist. A lot of my reading, I suppose, I do on the internet now. But it's obviously very different for children reading in that they've got lots of competition for their time. Instead of reading a book, they're maybe looking at a screen, but you still need to be able to read, don't you? That's the problem. And that even in 2025, the rate of literacy among primary school children, frankly, is, even though it's better than many, many other countries, it's still a bit of a disgrace when you think that a reasonably high percentage of children at the age of 16 can't read and can't write. How can you get on in life if you can't read and write? Well, the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has been addressing this because I didn't realise this, 2026 is the National Year of Reading. Now, she has put a different spin on this. She says that the decline in reading is a threat to British national security because it leaves children more vulnerable to Russian disinformation. She's written about this in the Telegraph, and she's sounding an alarm over the stark fall in the number of younger people picking up books for pleasure. Only 33% of children aged over 8 say they enjoy reading in their free time. Only 33%. Now, 2 decades ago, that was 51%. So that is quite a dramatic decline. So the Department of Education has joined with the National Literacy Trust to declare 2026 a National Year of Reading, with events being organised in a concerted campaign to reverse the trend. Well, I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that. I think any parent, any adult, is going to want children to read, and read a lot. Because if you don't read, how can you get those magical moments that those people of my generation used to get from imagining the scenes in the books that we were reading? The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Watership Down, all of those sort of books which evoke such vivid scenes in your mind. You can't get that from the internet, I don't think. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Now, she also cited the growing threat of deliberately misleading information from hostile states such as Russia, as she laid out why improving reading standards was so important. Now, this comes after Blaise Metrovelli, the new head of MI6, warned that disinformation as a tool of conflict was being used by Britain's adversaries. Ms. Phillipson wrote in the Telegraph, "This isn't just a nice-to-have. A decline of literacy, a dwindling of reading comprehension, could even have an impact on our security as a country. As we've heard in recent months, and in December from the head of MI6, the threat from Russia and from other foreign states is growing. And a dark new frontier is the disinformation spreading across social media and the wider internet. These threats are more sophisticated than ever, with higher production values designed to appear like legitimate news sources. To respond, we need a generation of critical thinkers. We need a generation of problem solvers, equipped to dissect what lands in front of them, to value the truth and to reject the easy temptation of the online world. In short, we need a generation of readers." Well, is she right? 0345 6060 973. And also, how have your own reading habits changed over the years? And if you look at what your children are reading, or possibly not reading, how's that different to your own childhood? 0345 6060 973. Henry Porter joins me, best-selling novelist and journalist. Henry, very good evening. I've done it again. It will be good evening from Monday. It's good afternoon, Henry.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Happy New Year, Ian.
And you. Now, listen, you've got a lot of experience in this area. Do you think Bridget Phillipson is onto something here?
I absolutely agree with her. And, I commend the government. I'm rather gloomy about this government. I don't think it's very imaginative. And it never. But this seems to be taking the initiative, and I really applaud her for doing so. And I agree with her piece in The Telegraph. There are lots of things to think about. It's not only about national security. It's about our ability to function in our democracy. You know, it's not just about, misinformation and black propaganda from Russia. It's about assessing our politicians with the tools of critical thinking. That's a very important thing. And that comes from reading.
Have our reading habits changed over the years, do you think? Why is it that there has been this decline among younger people?
I think you're right, Ian. It has been declined. Well, after all, they've all got phones, haven't they? So, if we lived in Australia, I think kids below 15 wouldn't have phones from now on. I kind of agree with that, because phones compete for attention, but it also, they do not help people concentrate, because you're endlessly moving from one subject or one stimulus to another. And they give you an entirely false satisfaction, I think. Whereas reading, I remember you were talking about the first book you read. The first book I completely read by myself was The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. And that, I can remember the moment, I can see where I was when I was reading it, and remembering the extraordinary enjoyment I got from it.
Yeah.
So I'd love kids, and I love my grandchildren who I spend time reading with, but they're not quite old enough to read a book by themselves. But I'd love kids to have that experience, because it's so important.
Well, it really is. And of course, books, not all, but many books that children read are quite educational, teach them about emotions in life, about the problems that adults have to cope with as well. It's sort of, they are, books actually lead, I think, children from childhood into adulthood in a way that looking at websites or apps never can.
Quite. It's a really important point. You do a lot of developing when you read. And I think it's absolutely essential for people's inner life. You know, if you're reading a book that nobody else really is reading at the moment, you're maybe reading John Buchan or Evelyn Waugh or anyone. I named two people that I read when I was young. You are having a relationship not only with that writer, not only when you've got the book in front of you, but during the day. You'll go back to thinking about it, thinking about the plot, thinking about the problems that the characters face. And that's incredibly important to develop, as you say, as an adult, but also it's enjoyable. You can think about the book while you're doing something else and not with the book. And it's really important that. I really wonder how you get kids to read, though. You know, I mean, there is so much competition for their attention. And of course, it's commercially important that big tech companies actually grab the attention of these kids and do not let them go off and develop on their own, because it's a commercial advantage to them. I'd just add that I think in the time of AI, which we are moving into with a great, great speed, I think it's really important that people learn to do their own thinking and not to let AI do everything for them, which will be a temptation. And that comes to actually thinking about politics and the news. You know, I think it's so important for a democracy that people learn to think.
I mean, I think AI is going to have a massive impact on all aspects of our lives, but particularly reading. I think you're absolutely right on that. But what you said a moment ago about attention span, I think, is also very important, because I don't know if you have this, but I mean, in the days gone by when I would literally lie on the couch for an hour or two and read a novel, which I just don't do anymore, but on the rare occasions that I do, I'm always distracted because I'll hear an email coming in, I'll hear a WhatsApp message coming in, and so you put your book down, you then look at those, you deal with them, and then go back to the book, and then 2 minutes later, you're dealing with another one. Now, this is all within our control to change, I suppose, but that is the reality of modern life, and it does impinge on reading habits.
I think you're right. My own experience, I had a period of not reading in the summer because I'm writing a book and I find it very hard to write a novel at the same time as reading them. And I hadn't read much for a month. And my experience was exactly the same as yours, endlessly being interrupted and being distracted and my attention wandering. But I read one book and then I was back into the habit of reading, which is incredibly important. I do most of my reading in bed. I tend not to sit in a chair and read, or on the train and so forth. But I just, you know, people out there, not just kids, but people have lost the habit of reading. I just implore them to, in 2026, to you know, pick up a book, any book, and plunge into it and lose yourself in it, because it's a fabulous experience,
I feel so sorry for teenagers now who haven't had the experience of the likes of that you and I have had in learning to enjoy books, not just books. Actually, I've got a text here which I'll read out in a few minutes, mentioning comics. Now, do comics exist in the same way that they did in the 60s and 70s? The Beano, Beezer, Roy of the Rovers, all of those sorts of things, yeah, which you and I grew up on. I don't think they exist anymore, do they?
They were wonderful. And they were, you know, you read them, that's the point. And they were great. And they were imaginative and clever. And you lived their world from week to week. They were wonderful.
Do you, for those people who maybe haven't read in many years, for whatever reason, do you have any advice on how they might go about choosing a new book to read which would get them back in the habit of reading?
Well, the big...
Apart from one of your own, obviously.
Yeah, well, I was going to send you my latest, which I think I have hopes of it being made into a film. So maybe you can wait to that happening. But I think, you know, many men do not read novels now, which I think is a pity, because it's a way of thinking about humanity, the human condition and so forth, and your neighbours and your fellows. Women are obsessed now, I know this because I look at my book figures, with a thing called, which is a sort of mixture of, I think it's called romanticy, which is romance and sex books mixed up with, you know, a bit of sci-fi and stuff, or not even sci-fi, but extremely, extremely imaginative scenarios. And these books are selling like hotcakes, and it's a big new thing. And to a degree, it's a reason the thriller market has slightly declined. I would do some, you know, think what interests you. Does a historical novel interest you? Does romance interest you? And just go after, look up best historical writers now or anything on the web. And you'll find a book that you love. I mean, the description of people who discover reading is so moving. You know, you start, occasionally you see people on Twitter saying, 10 years ago I didn't read, I started reading when I had a broken leg, or whatever it was. And their description of the way that it has enriched their lives is just so moving. You and I don't need that, perhaps, because we had a childhood in which we read and read and read. But for people discovering it, I feel terribly moved, you know?
Absolutely. Well, I totally agree with you. Henry, thank you very much indeed. That's Henry Porter there, novelist and journalist. If you are 14, 15, 16 years old and listening to this and you think, well, I don't really read, maybe I should, let me give you a tip. An author that I absolutely loved in my teenage years was a man called James Herbert, and he wrote horror books. And the first one I read was called The Rats, and it was all about a rat invasion of Epping Forest. And I related to this because my cousins lived in Epping Forest, and my uncle managed a farm estate around there. And I remember reading the whole series of books. There was The Rats, there was The Fog, Lair, Domain, Magic Cottage, and many, many more. And again, they fed your imagination, because you had to imagine these sort of horrific scenes. And they were really brilliant. They're still available. So anybody that hasn't read James Herbert, please do. I did interview him about 12 years ago when I used to do a book club hour on a Friday night. And he'd always been an absolute hero of mine. But shall we put it this way, he had aged considerably and was a little bit monosyllabic in the interview, and it took all my interviewing skills to get through the hour, I have to say. But he still remains an absolute hero of mine. So two or three questions here, really, to answer. Several of you are already phoning in. Is Bridget Phillipson right that she's warning that British national security is in danger if our children don't learn to read properly and basically have critical thinking faculties? How do you get people interested in reading if they haven't grown up in a house where books have just been part of everyday life? It's 19 minutes past 12.
This is LBC.
The Famous Five are at home, and Julian could barely contain his excitement. "Why are you so excited?" asked George. "Is it your birthday? Is it snowing?" asked Dick. "Are we having treacle sponge tonight?" asked Anne.
"No," said Julian. "It's the great GWR getaway sale."
The Great GWR Getaway Sale is now on. Hurry, book before January 5th at gwr.com or on the app.
Great Western Railway. Adventures start here.
Terms apply. Selected routes only. Travel by April 10th.
Well, that makes gold. Then earns points on obscure vintage football shirts. And cheesy chips before the match. And on tickets to the game. And you can put those points towards the cab home when they lose 4-0. And that's because Amex Gold lets you earn points on what you love and what you don't, to spend on things you like.
Representative 86.3% APR variable. Annual fee applies after the first year. Terms apply. 18 plus. Subject to approval.
At Kia, we have an award-winning range of electric cars for you to discover. From the compact SUV, the Kia EV3, and our latest hatchback, the Kia EV4, to our stylish new Kia EV5, the all-electric family SUV. Discover what driving electric really means. And if you order any Kia electric car by March 31st, you'll enjoy your first two services free. Search Discover Your Kia EV to book your test drive today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
T's and C's apply.
So, you're geared up for this Making Tax Digital thing?
Sure, I just need some new mud boards, bag of cavity tyres and a couple of lintels.
Hey, MTD, mate. Digital taxes.
Mm-hmm. It's an extension down Station Road on a corner.
Dave, digital taxes, mate.
Yeah. Probably will need some 2x4s. I want to go take the van in for a new fan belt. Squeaky.
Hey, Making Tax Digital, Dave.
Avoiding MTD. Sage makes tax simpler for sole traders. Search Sage MTD to get your free software today.
Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
21 minutes past 12 on LBC. Chris says, my son is 9, absolutely loves the Phoenix comics, and he looks forward to weekly subscriptions. They make books too, and he got their new book yesterday. He's already read it before he started these. He loved Dogman. No, me neither. I've not managed to get him interested in what I'd call proper books yet. The pictures and humour are a big part of it for him. He has ADHD and other barriers which have really held him back. It's taken us all a lot of effort to get him reading. Fortunately, the comic-style books are a big draw. I mean, it makes me think of Heartstopper, which many of you will know is a series on Netflix, all about two gay teenagers coming out. But that started life as a comic. And I wonder if that had started life as just an ordinary book, as a novel, whether it would have had the impact that it eventually had. Let's go to Linda, who's in Kidsgrove in Staffordshire. Hello, Linda.
Oh, good afternoon, Dale. I love the programme, hello. By the way.
You can call me by my first name, if you like.
Dale and Ian Dale, or Dale Ian, could be. I'll get it right in a minute. Having just spent 5 weeks in hospital, Dale, Ian, with no television and no radio, I was absolutely desperate for something to read. Anyway, the kind nurses went and got my morning paper. I absolutely adore reading. It kept me going. It really did. And I think a lot of things... I started off reading silly things when I was little, like The Dandy and The Beano.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of children will miss out on comics. They were such fun, and I've still got the original annuals as well. I've still kept those. I read anything. And people say, I can't afford books. Well, go to the library, go to charity shops. Even my little local chemist's has got a pile of books.
And the thing is, the price of books has barely changed in 30 years.
Not really, Daly. I mean, they're such good value, and then you can pass them on or swap them for something else. And my little chemist has got a wonderful selection of books. And he just put something in the charity box for Douglas Macmillan. And next door, you've got the Douglas Macmillan charity shop with piles of books in there. I think people are so stuck on the mobile phones. Oh, I haven't got time. I haven't got this. But they'll sit there messing about on the stupid mobile phones. I mean, they're missing out on such a lot.
Well, I think that's right. And I think anybody that comes to books late in life, say you didn't, I mean, obviously you could read, but you didn't read books until you were, say, in your 20s or 30s. I think you then think to yourself, oh, my God, what have I missed out on all of these years?
Yes, wonderful stories, yeah. I mean, I started off on Enid Blyton. Oh, dear, not supposed to mention Enid Blyton.
Enid Blyton is an amazing writer, and I think all kids should read them.
Yeah, I think I could go back and read them now. We know five go on an adventures with a ginger beer and
hang on a minute, Linda, you've got that wrong. It's Lashings of Ginger Beer.
Yes, sorry, Ian. Oh, yeah. I love them. I mean, I do feel sorry for people who think, oh, I've got a neighbour and I mention a book to her and she looks at me if I said something rude. You know, she hasn't got a book in the house.
No, of course, I mean, some of the books that we used to read, Enid Blyton ones, they wouldn't pass the woke censorship tests.
Oh, they get
now,
on my nerves. I take no notice of woke anyway. I read Dickens, I love history books, anything. And I tell you what I recommend to people, if they want a good laugh, and I really enjoyed them, is the Agatha Raisin mystery books. Have you heard of them?
No.
Character. Well, they did it on the television. It was nothing like the books. MC Beaton wrote the books. Oh, and they're ever so good, Dale. Ian. They're really, really good. And they're funny. It's a funny series of books, really enjoyable, but I'd recommend them to anybody, though, Ian. They're really, really good, yeah.
Linda, we got there in the end. Thank you very much indeed. Happy New Year to you. Mike says, on reading, my eight-year-old and I have started reading together in the evening. It's connected us in a magical way, and I'd encourage everyone to do it. We get so much out of it, and he's reading independently as well as in his spare time. As parents, we must put the effort in and try to generate that spark to read independently for them. I think that is absolutely true. An eight-year-old that I know is absolutely into his reading, is also into his screen, spends far too much time looking at screens. But I gave him last Christmas the three volumes of The Magic Faraway Tree, and I said, look, this is what I was reading at your age. Just try it and see what you think. And he's absolutely addicted to it now. And I feel he's not my nephew or godson or anything. He's the son of a friend of mine. But I feel I've done a good thing there. And hopefully it's encouraged a love of reading for life. Sarah is in Finchley. Hello, Sarah.
First of all, I'm amazed you've got the bravery to... Sorry, first of all, I've got a bad throat. You're very brave to laud Enid Blyton, because she's been definitely cancelled years ago for being far too middle class and for having far too simplistic language. However, she could certainly hold a plot, couldn't she? She could hold your attention.
Yeah.
It was absolutely fabulous. Right, first of all, I think you'll find the research about only a third of reading, I don't think you will find it applies to those in even not very good private schools. Like so many things with education at the moment, be it sport or art or everything, there is a huge difference between, I think you'll find that, you know, between the reading of kids who are in private schools and those that are in sort of state schools. I think it's a, as you said, it's a prevailing sort of cultural thing. I was very lucky, and we always talk about it, me and my friends, that we grew up in the 50s and 60s, and I can thank, surprisingly, the CND movement, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, because it was sort of somehow became infiltrated in a good way to do with a certain kind of intellectualism, and you had to have great philosophers of the East tucked away in your pocket, in your duffel coat. And it was just CND and other things meant that there was a lot of reading. We read so much, and it wasn't just English things. It was novelists, you know, French novelists. It was a whole huge range. And I reckon we were so lucky to be involved in that. I think it has a lot to do with schools, and particularly the state schools, as has already been raised. It has to be a cultural thing. It has to be, in many, many ways, you know, reading has to be extended and lauded and everything else. And as other people have said, you're up against screen time and phones and all the other distractions. But it is, if the prevailing culture can be that it's cool and it's interesting and et cetera, to read, it will... You know, we can recreate what happened in the 50s and 60s. Funnily enough, I always used to boast, other than maybe very technical books, like on engineering or something, I don't think there's any book that I haven't read. Now you're going to challenge me and say, have you read Vaccines?
I would not dream of it, but I'll tell you what, Sarah, I'm going to bring you some brilliant news imparted by Graham in Margate, who tells us... There's a film of The Magic Faraway Tree coming out this year. The trailer's already online. Well, I don't know about you, but I should be going to see that.
It's funny you said about The Faraway Tree, because my kids, well, I've now got grandchildren, they all loved it. They all, you know, the thing is, Enid Blyton got kids reading, and she could tell a wonderful plot, especially the adventure ones. And I don't think they should try and change the language, because if they were written with kids saying, you know, mother, have you got my fish paste sandwiches ready, you know, before father comes home from the office, in brackets with his pipe and his hat, that's how it was written. No, but that's how it was written.
Well, Tom and Summer actually did
touch on themes other than, you know, there were books that had a lot about underprivileged kids, etc., etc. Funnily enough, I have, just to end, two of the most intelligent people I've met and extremely well-read and have done very, very well in life, etc., etc., mostly only read Enid Blyton for many years. So it didn't do them any harm, as they say, and it, you know, that's just a funny irony.
Well, you'll be delighted to hear that Tom in Somerset tells us that his six-year-old is having The Faraway Tree read to him at a state school at the moment. Enid Blyton has not been cancelled there, he says. Sarah, great call. Happy New Year. Thank you very much indeed. So we're going to come back to more of your calls in a moment. We're also going to hear from the Conservative MP, Tom Tugendhat, who's a real expert on Iran, which we were talking about in the 10 o'clock hour. He's going to tell us why what's happening in Iran matters to us in this country. It's 12:31. News headlines with James Kitchen.
The first victim of the Swiss ski resort fire has been named as the Italian teenage golfer Emmanuel Galapini. More than 40 people have died in the New Year incident in Crans-Montana. The Italian foreign minister has been visiting the scene. He says something clearly went wrong, adding the use of fireworks inside the venue seems inappropriate. A man's been charged with murder following the death of a 24-year-old man in Bury on New Year's Eve. Police say 25-year-old Anthony Junior Murray is also charged with possession of a bladed article. And from today, a chickenpox vaccine is being rolled out on the NHS for the first time. Children across the UK will be offered the combined MMRV jab, protecting against measles, mumps, rubella and chickenpox. LBC weather, amber warnings for heavy snow showers in parts of northern Scotland this afternoon. Clearer further south with sunny spells, feeling cold, highs of 6 degrees.
This is LBC.
The Famous Five are at home, and Julian could barely contain his excitement.
Why are you so excited? Asked George. Is it your birthday? Is it snowing? Asked Dick. Are we having treacle sponge tonight? Asked Anne.
No, said Julian. It's the Great GWR Getaway Sale.
The Great GWR Getaway Sale is now on. Hurry, book before January 5th at gwr.com or on the app. Great Western Railway. Adventures start here. Terms apply. Selected routes only. Travel by April 10th.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature, biotiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful Gut Health. Upgrade your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir. And reset your gut health with Biotiful. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 991234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
You know that guy I've been seeing?
Yeah.
Turns out my sister's been seeing him too.
Oh, really?
And I heard he's been seeing Kelly at number 56. And Dave.
Your brother?
Yep.
Specsavers opticians and audiologists own and run their stores, so your care is their business, which can make them rather popular.
I've got something to tell you. I've got half an hour with him this afternoon.
Specsavers, your care is our business. Book an appointment today.
This is LBC with Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060973.
12:34. Here's another text from Charlotte in Suffolk, who says, whenever you talk about your personal experiences as a young boy, I think we must have been twins in another dimension. I adored reading Enid Blyton as a child too. The Faraway Tree was my favourite, and I can still visualise the characters in my mind. I also love the Choose Your Own Adventure series, which allowed the reader to make decisions and choose alternative endings for your character. Wonderful for the imagination. I found myself digging out recently and just transported me back to my being eight again. I think that's such an important thing to say, that these books that people come across do transport you back. I know when my father died and my sisters and I were sort of clearing out the house, I could not bring myself to, well, I could never bring myself to throw books away. I think it's almost a criminal offence to throw a book away. So I've kept all of my childhood books, haven't got a clue what to do with them really, but I did start sort of dipping into them and sort of rereading bits, and it just evokes so many memories, doesn't it? 0345 6060 973. Now, if you were listening at 10 o'clock, you'll have heard us do an hour on the protests that are happening in Iran at the moment. And one of the constant themes of certainly the text rather than the calls was what on earth has this got to do with us? Well, Tom Tugendhat is Conservative MP for Tunbridge, also former security minister, and joins me now. Good afternoon, Tom, and thanks for coming on the programme. Do you find also, and I was reading a thread on Twitter that you where you explained why you think what's happening in Iran is important to people in the UK. Just tell our listeners.
Sure. Well, Ian, there's always an idea that these are faraway countries and they're nothing to do with us. Now, I'm not, certainly don't confuse this for an advocation that we should be doing anything, getting involved in the process. That's not what I'm arguing. I'm just trying to explain why it matters to us. Look, first of all, Iran has in the past pumped more than 6 million barrels a day. Now, that's a huge amount of oil. It's about half what Saudi Arabia pumps. So if they're able to come back onto the market, not only will that lower the price of energy for the UK, and that means lowering the price of energy for every single function that is carried out, whether that's delivering bread or making cars or whatever it happens to be. So that's a price cut for everyone in the UK. Secondly, it means that countries like China that have been sanctions busting won't be able to get their cheap deals. And so the cost of manufacturing will go up for them. Now, that will equalize the playing field a little bit between the two of us. But that's not even the most important thing. The most important thing is the fact that over the last few years, over the last decade or so, Iran has carried out more than 20 attempted assassinations and attacks here in the United Kingdom. Now, that's a huge number of attempts on various people's lives, and that takes up a huge amount of effort. It means that our intelligence and security forces are very dominated by what's going on in Iran, and they're very focused on the kind of operations that the Iranian so-called IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, is carrying out here in the United Kingdom and around Europe. And, of course, it means that they're busy, distracted, if you like, from other things. Now, here's the other thing that they're distracted from, because actually the IRGC and indeed the Ayatollahs from Iran have been stirring up racial and religious hatred here in the United Kingdom. A lot of the groups that call themselves Free Palestine, a lot of the outfits that are connected to anti-Semitism that sadly we've seen exploding in the last 2-3 years, have got connections to the Iranian state, to the Iranian regime. So for all those reasons, what happens in Iran, I'm afraid, has a direct implication on what happens in the UK.
Why is it that the British government, either under the Conservatives or Labour, have not banned the IRGC as a terrorist organisation?
So it's interesting. It's one of the things I looked at when I was security minister. I'm personally in favour of doing it. I made that point to various different prime ministers when I was the security minister. But let's be completely clear. Prescription, as it's called, banning in that sense, in the UK sense, is much, much stricter than any other prescription. It's much stricter than American prescription, for example, or Canadian or Australian. The word doesn't mean quite the same thing. So instead of doing that, what I did was I brought in the new National Security Act. So it's called the NSA 2023, National Security Act 2023. And what that does is it makes any cooperation with a foreign state organisation a crime. Now, you could argue that we could prescribe and that would do the job. But the difference between the IRGC and, for example, Hamas or the IRA is that they are non-state actors, by which I mean they're not part of a recognised government. Now, according to UK law, and of course you could change this, but according to current UK law, states can only commit war crimes. They can't commit terrorism. Terrorism is always committed by non-state actors. If a state does the same thing as a terrorist group, that's called a war crime. Now, again, this is use of language rather than a fundamental difference. So what we did in 2023 is we brought in the same powers as prescription, effectively, but against a state actor, in this case, the IRGC.
Now, Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, she said today that the decline in reading is a threat to Britain's national security. Now, when I read that, I thought, really? That's stretching it a bit. But actually, reading her article in The Telegraph today, I don't know if you've seen it, but do you think she's got a point on that? Because she says, effectively, if you can't read properly or if you're not reading, you're less capable of really analysing what's fake, what is, and what is disinformation and what isn't.
So look, it's interesting. I mean, just going back to the Iran protest that we've been seeing, you and I have been watching the various different things on Twitter. I don't know how many of your listeners have as well. But we've seen any number of different videos, some of which may be real, some of which may be fake. There's quite a lot of people who are claiming that chants in favour of the Islamic Republic are going on. And when you look at them, actually, they date to 2025 or indeed some of them to 2020, 2022. Now, you need to have critical thinking if you're going to use social media. And reading is absolutely essential. So I'm not normally a fan of Bridget, but I think on this she's absolutely right. The truth is, the biggest threat to the United Kingdom is not terrorism, is not even foreign states, it's us tearing ourselves apart. And if we don't have a common language, by which I don't just mean English, but I mean a common understanding of our culture and our history, then that makes it easier for those like Russia who are trying to separate us and make us feel foreigners in our own home.
Tom, one of my predictions this year, when I did my top 10 predictions for 2026, was that you would return to the shadow cabinet. If you were asked, would you go back?
Look, I have this conversation every now and again with Kemi. She's a very, very dear friend, and I'm a huge supporter of hers. I want her to be the next Prime Minister. She would be a fantastic Prime Minister, and I think she's already demonstrating why people like me have had such faith in her for so long. At the moment, I'm really enjoying freedom, and you'll understand this better than anyone, Ian. There are moments in politics where you have to focus on whatever it is you've been asked to focus on. So, for example, 5 years as Foreign Affairs Committee Chair, you just focus on foreign policy. Then 2 years as Security Minister. You will have noticed, having done a lot of media before and afterwards, I didn't do any as Security Minister. There's a reason for that. You're there to keep the King's secrets, and that's what I did. So I'm enjoying the opportunity of talking about the economy, talking about the challenges that we're seeing for young people, talking about growth, talking about all those other things that you can't do if you're in the shadow cabinet, because you have to stick to your lane. Otherwise, it doesn't work. You know, life is a team game. So very, very sweetly, Kemi has allowed me a little bit of latitude, and she hasn't quite asked, and I haven't quite said no. So it's one of those. We are very close friends, though. So it's at some point, I suspect, I'm going to find she asked formally, and then I'll be stumped.
Well, okay, Tom, thank you very much indeed. That's Tom Tugendhat, the Conservative MP for Tunbridge. Right, back to reading. Richard is in Muswell Hill. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Ian. Yeah, listen, I'm not an education expert, but I can give you two examples, and they're my daughters. So my elder daughter did English literature at school and got an A star at A level. And my younger daughter did English GCSE and got a 9, which is a top mark. And neither of them read any of the books front to back. Not at all. Because the whole exam system is geared about, you know, the interaction between this character and that character and, you know, a particular thread in the plot or whatever. And so rather than read the books, they just read the crib notes and question spot, basically. And so neither of them have grown up with a sort of real love for reading. They've just used reading as a, they haven't read the books, basically. They've just worked out how to pass the exams in the most efficient manner, which, I don't know, kudos to them, I guess, but it kind of defeats the object, I think, really, of, you know, in sitting back in a chair and enjoying a good novel or a good history book or whatever. And our house is absolutely full of books. I've got a massive library, and it covers everything to everything, basically, from science to the Plantagenets to Tudors to war history to Wuthering Heights. I mean, I sat there reading Wuthering Heights a few months ago, and they looked at me like I dropped off the planet Zog, because they were sitting engrossed. And both of them sat there going, oh, we were supposed to read that for our exams, but we never read it. We did such and such and such and such. So I think there's something fundamentally wrong with the way we teach our kids, or the way our parents kind of get them off the computers and stick them in a quiet room with a book and say, you know, read, or give them the space to read. Because, you know, it's something that our generation, you know, I'm sort of same sort of age as you, will have grown up doing all the time, because we didn't have the internet, we didn't have phones, you know, we couldn't just jump in an Uber and go out with our mates or whatever. And so we'd pick up a book and read it and lose ourselves in that for a few hours a day, basically.
Well, I wonder if the way to reawaken their love of reading, if it was ever there in the first place, judging from what you've said, I think they need to get a copy of How to Be Right by James O'Brien and Margaret Thatcher, a short biography by someone called Ian Dale. I think that would do the trick.
Well, James O'Brien's book, the guys, the people that broke Britain. I got halfway through, and one of your books, which was Prime Ministers, an anthology of prime ministers. I have to say, Ian, that wasn't the most riveting of books that you authored.
Niche interest. Well, I edited. I didn't author it. I edited it, which is slightly
different. You edited it, yeah. And,
well, I'll tell you what. If in a year's time you buy my autobiography, which is coming out in July, it's called Have I Said Too Much? If in a year's time we have this conversation and you say you've only got a quarter of a way through it, I should be dreadfully insulted, Richard. Thank you very much indeed. Now, there's talking of Wuthering Heights, there's a big Wuthering Heights film coming out this year, directed by the same person who did Saltburn, Emerald Fennell. He's the director. Was it she? I don't know. And it stars Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi. What a fabulous surname, Elordi. Right, we will come back to more of your calls in a few moments' time. It's 12:46.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
New business rates are due in spring, but there are warnings some high streets are already facing collapse. The MMR jab will now include chickenpox vaccine and the latest on the Swiss fire tragedy.
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Did you know Vets for Pets are
the nation's most trusted vets?
We think that's because they're
locally owned
and locally loved.
Wherever you are,
we've got a vet local to you.
Vets for Pets. We're all for pets. Based on a survey. To verify, search vetsforpets.com/allforpets.
The following is from TfL.
My name was Luna, like the moon. I was 2 days short of my 17th birthday when I was killed. My killer wasn't a bad man. He'd had a rescue dog called Frank and rang his mum every Sunday. He wasn't a speed freak. He just thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit. But that was enough to knock me off my bike and kill me.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Get that Euro Millions feeling this Friday. 10 UK winners are guaranteed to be millionaires. That's 10 more reasons to celebrate. Not a bad way to start the new year. Euro Millions from the National Lottery. Play on app.
Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
At ulisprosperity.com, you buy the car and we pay you up to £600 per month in rental income. For conditions, visit ulisprosperity.com.
Right now, you can get hearing devices from only £495 at Specsavers. Now, we know what you're thinking. Oh, if they're that cheap, they're bound to be those big old-fashioned ones that do this kind of thing. As well as this kind of thing. But actually, they just do this kind of thing. Clear sound from a piece of tech so small you can barely see it. All from only £495. So book a free hearing check at Specsavers now. Terms and conditions apply. See our website for details.
Cross Question with Ian Dale.
Now you're saying that doctors going on strike because they want more pay is a disgrace. I think you need, Andrew, a lesson in what is a disgrace.
Monday to Thursday from 8 p.m.
What you demonstrate is the lack of understanding as to how farming is financed.
Listen and watch on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
If you choose to not work and not get educated these days, you end up getting paid by everybody else.
Cross Question.
Welcome to Monday's Cross Question with me, Ian Dale, on the panel tonight.
Only on LBC. This is LBC. Message Ian Dale on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
And Cross Question returns on Monday from 8 o'clock on LBC. Sadly, Simon Marks won't be on it, but he's with me now.
I'm excited to be on it at some point. I know you,
and you will be. Now we're now we're 4 days, but you might be on more often than you might want to be. Right, you're not here to talk about Cross Question. You are here to talk about the Mayor of New York, who's being... It's inaugurated, the right word today.
It is. Well, he was inaugurated
yesterday right.
And actually, he's had two inaugurals, because, of course, they do an official swearing-in ceremony on the stroke of midnight at the start of the year, which he did in front of the City Hall underground stop, the subway station in New York City. But because that happens at midnight and people aren't generally watching, then the following day there's the ceremonial inauguration. So he was sworn in again yesterday by Bernie Sanders, the socialist. Because it's a made-for-TV swearing-in ceremony. I mean, it's a made-for-TV ceremonial event, because that's when he gets to make his inaugural address. So the first night, he was sworn in by Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York. Now he's been sworn in again by Bernie Sanders, the socialist warhorse from Vermont. And he made a stirring and rousing inaugural address, absolutely focused on, of course, his grassroots supporters, but I think also designed to send a wider message.
We will govern expansively and audaciously. We will govern without shame and insecurity, making no apology for what we believe. I was elected as a democratic socialist, and I will govern as a democratic socialist.
And when he says there, I was elected as a democratic socialist and I will govern as a democratic socialist, he is not just sending a message to the people who voted for him because they were attracted by his progressive left-wing policies. He is, I think, also sending a message to other elements in the Democratic Party, some of the party's grandees, who were very wary about embracing him because of the S word. Some of them have even argued the party must never, ever use the word socialist to describe where it wants to take the country. They believe the American people in large measure are not programmed to receive that word. Here's a bit more of what the new mayor of New York City had to say last night.
I will not abandon my principles for fear of being deemed radical. I stand alongside countless more New Yorkers watching from cramped kitchens in Flushing and barbershops in East New York, from cell phones propped against the dashboards of parked taxi cabs at LaGuardia, from hospitals in Mott Haven and libraries in El Barrio that have too long known only neglect.
So this was a speech that absolutely underscored what his critics argue is a radical agenda, an agenda that is going to implement free buses in New York City, free childcare, is going to freeze in place and extend rent regulation for a million properties in the city. And this is a big test that is now coming up. Can progressive left-wing politics deliver in that audacious way that Zoran Mamdani is promised? And how's he going to deal with the day-to-day? Because at some point soon, New York may be blanketed with a massive snowstorm. He's going to be more instantly judged on his handling of that kind of thing than some of the long-term aims and ambitions, audacious though they are, that he's got for government.
Now, in normal circumstances, the Democratic Party might be looking at him and thinking, well, he's somebody who could take the fight to Donald Trump and be our next presidential candidate. But that can't happen, can it?
It cannot happen in the case of Zoran Mamdani, because he was born in Kampala in Uganda, spent part of his childhood as well in South Africa. That is doesn't matter in this context. It's the fact that he was born overseas, is not a natural-born U.S. citizen on American soil, that prevents him from running for the presidency. But there are many other figures out there who share his kind of firebrand radicalism who could run, including one of the people who was there speaking at that inauguration yesterday, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, also from New York, also considered someone who from the left is likely to challenge one day for the American presidency. The real question here, though, Ian, is he the kind of candidate? Is his politics the kind of politics that the Democratic Party writ large is willing to embrace? And there are also questions, of course, about the fact that Donald Trump, who was very hostile towards Zoran Mamdani on the campaign trail, as soon as he won the election, had the mayor-elect, as he was then, into the White House. We all thought there were going to be fisticuffs. It was going to be another Zelensky moment in the Oval Office. And lo and behold, they found that they managed to find a way of getting on. And that is reflective of the fact that partly Donald Trump's worried about his own business interests in New York going forwards. But it's also reflective of the fact that both of these men have romped to election victory based on platforms that they say are going to be championing working people. And while they come from radically different perspectives and ideologies, when they met in that Oval Office, Donald Trump actually found that some of the things that Mamdani wanted to do and why he wanted to do them were not radically different from some elements of the Make America Great Again agenda.
Well, if you believe in the circular theory of politics, the extreme right
exactly.
and the extreme left,
eventually they meet. Yeah, exactly.
They meet. What's the one book that you remember from your childhood?
You don't hear a lot about this author anymore. I don't think you do anyway. Listeners will be able to correct me. Leon Garfield. But when I was a youngster, Leon Garfield novels were devoured by kids, certainly in my neck of the woods. And I loved Smith by Leon Garfield, which tells the story of this London ragamuffin who is in the back alleys of the city and picks someone's pocket. And an entire drama unfolds as a result of that. But all the Leon Garfield books, certainly from my memory, were absolutely terrific. And I just don't know if he's part of the curriculum anymore.
Basically, one London ragamuffin to another.
Exactly. I identified, you see.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. That's Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent. He will be with you from 4 o'clock this afternoon on LBC. We've just got time to go to Tim in Rutland. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Ian. It's lovely to talk to you.
And you.
Yes, I was saying that I couldn't read till I was 12. Then life got in the way. But at 55, I retired and started reading again. And it's fantastic. I've got through over 100 books, all sorts, history, dark comedy, factual.
In how long?
In about 5 years.
That's not bad.
So a book every couple of weeks. Some of them are 700 pages long, so they take a bit longer. But I've just finished a fantastic book, Dip Your Brain in Joy, by Yvonne Innes. Do you remember the Rutland Weekend TV?
I do, yes.
And it's his wife's written a biography, and a plug for that one would be fantastic. The brilliant book. He died 2019. But
okay,
the other point I was going to make...
All right, very quickly.
You talked about the price of books not going up, not great for authors. My partner's just had her first novel published, Finch's Arms by Laz Newton. A £10 sale on Amazon gets her 87p.
And she shouldn't spend it all at once, Tim. Thank you very much indeed. Now, Sheila Fogarty has just sat down. Now, I imagine you were a very voracious reader as a child.
I'm still quite a voracious reader, but I was as a child, yeah. My friend and I used to go to the local library. Thank you, Andrew Carnegie. The local library every Saturday, get our homework done, and then we'd both get a book out each above and beyond our school reading, and we'd swap that book halfway through the week, so we both read two books a week. Above and beyond our
school. You're basically a role model to us all, aren't you?
I'm a little swot, is what I am. A happy little swot.
Right, we'll end on a high note. Pete in Nottinghamshire says, my wife tells me that there is nothing more attractive than a man with a book in his pocket. We'll leave that one there. Thanks for all of your calls and messages throughout the week here on LBC. I'm back on Monday evening at 7 o'clock. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, Simon Marks is yet again in for Tom Swarbrick, but first, in for herself, it's Sheila Fogarty. I'll never get tired of that.
You make me sound very selfish and mean. In for myself and nobody else. Mwahaha, evil laughter ensues. Thank you very much. Have a lovely weekend, Dale.
Dale, yeah.
I could stop laughing
that was
at that.
Brilliant,
it was very good. It was very amusing. Have a great weekend. Ian, have a great weekend. Coming up after the news, story's just broken. Coroner's warning that further babies could die unless the government introduces regulation of non-therapeutic male circumcision following the death of a six-month-old boy in West London. More of that after two. The MMR jab will now include a chickenpox vaccine as well. We'll talk about that at three, because there's still some fallout, I think, from the Andrew Wakefield thing all those years ago, isn't there? So we'll see how that feels to you. But I'm going to start with the government and business, the relationship between the two. New business rates are due in spring, but there are warnings that some high streets are already facing collapse. Can Labour repair the relationship?
on your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, photos of a basement bar in a Swiss ski resort appear to show people carrying champagne bottles with sparklers moments before a fire began. At least 40 people are thought to have died in the flames, which broke out during a New Year's party in Crans-Montana. One of the first victims to be named is a teenage Italian golfer, Emmanuel Galapini. This man, who lives locally, says it's unimaginable something like this could happen.
It just goes to show that this can happen anywhere, to anyone, at any point in time. And I think it's a reminder to all of us to always appreciate life, because it can happen even in Crans-Montana, where, you know, not in a million years you would imagine that this would happen.
A man's been charged with murder following the death of a 24-year-old man in Bury on New Year's Eve. Police say 25-year-old Anthony Junior Murray is also charged with possession of a bladed article. A vaccine protecting against chickenpox is being rolled out on the NHS for the first time. Children across the UK will be offered a combined jab alongside the MMR vaccine. Until now, parents wanting to protect their children have had to pay up to £200 for the vaccine privately. Stephanie Tingley, who's a nurse at Great Ormond Street Hospital, says it's a positive development.
There's some children or families that are worried about their children going to school because of catching chickenpox, because it can make them really unwell. As a previous intensive care nurse, I've seen children that have been hospitalised because of it. And if we can do anything to reduce the effects of chickenpox, I think it's brilliant.
Meanwhile, the number of people hospitalised with flu in England has fallen for the second week in a row. NHS figures suggest the number of patients last week with the virus was down 13%. And the FTSE 100 has broken through 10,000 points for the first time, hitting a new all-time high as markets reopened for the new year. It was reached within a half hour of the first day of trading. Head of markets at AJ Bell, Dan Coatsworth, told LBC the index had its fifth best year ever in 2025.
And what was driving that was interest in mining stocks, because the gold and silver price went up. Defence stocks like BAE Systems and Rolls-Royce. There's more money going to be spent by governments in various parts of the world on defence.
In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 40 points at 99.71. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather: amber warnings for heavy snow showers in parts of northern Scotland this afternoon. Clearer further south with sunny spells. Generally feeling cold. Highs of 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm James Kitchen.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. It's at this very early part of the new year when some people are back at work, some people are not back at work. Business owners are probably always really at work one way or another, maybe taking Christmas Day and Boxing Day off. But if you run your own business and employ people, I'm sure that the nuts and bolts of that, physical and metaphorical, are always part of your thinking. So I wanted to start the year focusing on not just how businesses are faring, you will tell me about your own business, but also the relationship between government and businesses, perhaps especially small and medium-sized businesses, and how that has been affected by the kind of policies we've seen from Rachel Reeves, from the government in the last year and a half, I guess. There's a warning today from a Labour MP, Rachel Maskell. She told LBC that the high street, in her view, could collapse without changes to what she described as an excruciating rise in business rates. And we know from the Chancellor's most recent announcements that a new business rate system will be introduced from the next financial year, which I presume means from the spring. And again, the detail of that isn't yet known exactly. It's something that many of you were crying out for in conversations that we've had over the past year about keeping your business afloat. But there's also the whole question of the changes to NI that businesses experienced in the first Labour budget. There's also the changes in the national minimum wage, also changes coming in the Workers' Rights Bill as well, that do cause some concerns for many businesses. And there's a sense that, seems to me anyway, there's a sense that The relationship has suffered a bit of a dent from those heady days just before the general election, when business leaders and business men and women like you were lining up to say it's time to give Labour a chance and we'll put our trust in them. They managed to get a few very high profile donors as well, didn't they, from the Conservative Party before they were elected. But it feels very different now. So I want to really, with your help, take the temperature on A, that relationship between Labour, the government and businesses, your business, and how your business is faring, and whether as you start January, there is a sense of confidence. Interesting to hear the FTSE. I mean, obviously the FTSE index is not directly related, is it, to the kind of businesses that you might run? But the Prime Minister yesterday talking about a greater sense of confidence coming round the corner. Is that reflected in your business life, in the business that you run and the pressures that you face? 0345 6060 973, the number to call. You can text 84850. Here's what the Labour MP Rachel Maskell said yesterday when she spoke to Simon Marks.
We certainly will be taking representations from our constituencies of things that aren't working so well to the Prime Minister, for instance, business rates. After a busy Christmas period heading into the new year, we're seeing those business rates massively challenged, with the revaluation coming with the lifting of relief at the same time. And businesses in my constituencies are saying, which is a successful high street, that they may not be here in 12 months if emergency measures aren't put in place.
Well, Jay says by text, my local high street, in fact, Jay begins by saying, oh, Sheila, in a kind of despairing way. My local high street goes like this: betting shop, chicken shop, pub, betting shop, chicken shop, pub, kebab shop, chicken shop, betting shop, pub. I've even taken to using the back street so I don't have to walk along the high street. No wonder they're going to pot. Well, not every high street is that bad, but I know what you're describing, Jay. Thanks for your text. Martin McTague joins me to talk about this, the National Chair of the Federation of Small Businesses, the FSB. Good afternoon to you, Martin. Thank you for joining me.
Good afternoon, Sheila.
Would you say that the relationship is dented between small, medium-sized businesses and the government?
Yeah, I think it's been damaged since the government was elected. And some of the kind of unhelpful spin around the budget on business rates wasn't, you know, I think it ends up damaging confidence in government statements, because the reality was that although there was a big reduction in the rate of business rates charged, there was a massive revaluation on most high streets. So the net result is that most retailers were facing quite a significant increase. Now, the government must have known that. So just to sort of represent one part of that equation wasn't very helpful. And, you know, I think you described it in your opening comments. There's a sort of perfect storm of different costs that are impacting on retailers. I don't share Rachel's pessimism about, you know, this means that the high street is going to be completely decimated. There is a lot of innovation, a lot of entrepreneurial spirit out there still. And when you talk to the average, you know, person who wants to shop in the high street, they like to see a wide variety of independent shops. They like to see that. So I don't think the future of the high street is finished, but this issue is something that needs to be resolved.
And you can see, I can certainly see it in my local high street, you can see change of use to not just pub, chicken shop, better shop, you know, but you can see changes of uses happening that look to me to be good and solid and substantial. But you can also see, you know, and I live in an area that would be regarded as pretty, you know, people fairly comfortably off, but you can see these really temporary installations in what used to be a long established shop. You can see local cafes where you knew the owner and she or he had been there for years, and they've gone to